import farmers, retire older soldiers, start production here on a much larger scale than they'd ever tried before. Others disagreed. There was a reason the unclaimed hills weren't densely inhabited. It would be a harsh life here. Rock buds grew smaller, crops would be less productive. And founding a new kingdom during a desolation? Better to protect what they had. Alethkar could probably feed Urethiru, but that depended on Kaladin and Elikar recovering the capital. Their tour ended with a meal at Dalinar's bunker, in his former sitting room, which looked bare now that most of the furniture and rugs had been removed to Urethiru. After the meal, he found himself standing by the window, feeling oddly out of place. He'd left this war camp only 10 weeks ago, but the place was at once deeply familiar and also no longer his. Behind him, Navani and her scribe ate fruit as they chatted quietly over some sketches that Navani had done.
"Oh, but I think that the others need to experience that brightness," the scribe said. "The flight was remarkable. How fast do you think we were going? I believe we might have attained a speed that no human has reached since the Recreants. Think about that, Navani. Surely we were faster than the fastest horse or ship."
"Focus, Rushu," Navani said. "My sketch."
"I don't think this math is right, Brightness. No, that sail will never stand."
"It's not meant to be completely accurate," Navani said. "Just a concept. My question is, can it work?"
"We'll need more reinforcement." "Yes, more reinforcement for certain. And then the steering mechanism, definitely work to do there. This is clever, though, Brightness. Falalar needs to see it. He will be able to say whether or not it can be built."
Dalinar glanced away from the window, catching Navani's eye. She smiled. She always claimed that she wasn't a scholar, but a patron of scholars. She said her place was to encourage and guide the real scientists. Anyone who saw the light in her eyes as she took out another sheet and sketched her idea further knew she was being too modest. She began another sketch, but then stopped and glanced to the side where she'd set out a span reed. The ruby was blinking.
"Fen," Dalinar thought.
The Queen of Thelena had asked that, in this morning's high storm, Dalinar send her into the vision of Ahare Etiam, which she knew about from the published accounts of Dalinar's visions. He'd reluctantly sent her alone, without supervision. They'd been waiting for her to speak of the event, to say anything. In the morning, she hadn't replied to their requests for a conversation. Navani prepared the span reed, then set it writing. It scribbled for only a brief moment.
"That was short," Dalinar said, stepping toward her.
"Only one word,"
Navani said. She looked up at him.
"Yes."
Dalinar heaved out a long breath. She was willing to visit Urethiru.
Finally.
"Tell her we'll send her a radiant."
He left the window, watching as she replied. In her sketchpad, he caught sight of some kind of ship-like contraption, but with the sail on the bottom. What in the world? Fen seemed content to leave the conversation there, and Navani returned to her discussion of engineering, so Dalinar slipped from the room. He passed through his bunker, which felt hollow, like the rind of a fruit with the pulp scooped out. No servants scuttling back and forth, no soldiers. Kaladin and his men had gone off somewhere, and Kadash was probably at the camp monastery. He'd been keen to get there, and Dalinar had been gratified by his willingness to fly with Kaladin. They hadn't spoken much since their confrontation in the sparring room. Well, perhaps seeing the Windrunner's power firsthand would improve Kadash's opinion of the Radiance. Dalinar was surprised, and secretly pleased, to find that no guards had been posted at the bunker's back door. He slipped out alone and headed to the War Camp Monastery. He wasn't looking for Kadash. He had another purpose. He soon arrived at the monastery, which looked like most of the war camp, a collection of buildings with the same smooth, rounded construction, crafted from the air by Alethi soulcasters. This place had a few small, hand-built buildings of cut stone, but they looked more like bunkers than places of worship. Dalinar had never wanted his people to forget that they were at war. He strolled through the campus and found that, without a guide, he didn't know his way among the nearly identical structures. He stopped in a courtyard between buildings. The air smelled of wet stone from the high storm, and a nice group of shellbark sculptures rose to his right, shaped like stacks of square plates. The only sound was water dripping from the eaves of the buildings. Storms, he should know his way around his own monastery, shouldn't he?
How often did you actually visit here during all the years in the war camps?
He'd meant to come more often and talk to the Ardents in his chosen devotary. There had always been something more pressing, and besides, the Ardents stressed that he didn't need to come. They had prayed and burned glyph wards on his behalf. That was why High Lords owned Ardents. Even during his darkest days of war, they had assured him that, in pursuing his calling, by leading his armies, he served the Almighty. Dalinar stooped into a building that had been divided into many small rooms for prayers. He walked down a hallway until he stepped through a storm door into the atrium, which still smelled faintly of incense. It seemed insane that the Ardents would be angry with him now, after training him his whole life to do as he wished. But he'd upset the balance, rocked the boat. He moved among braziers filled with wet ash. Everyone liked the system they had. The Light Eyes got to live without guilt or burden, always confident that they were active manifestations of God's will. The Dark Eyes got free access to training in a multitude of skills. The Ardents got to pursue scholarship. The best of them lived lives of service. The worst lived lives of indolence. But what else were important light-eyed families going to do with unmotivated children? A noise drew his attention, and he left the courtyard and looked into a dark corridor. Light poured from a room at the other end, and Dalinar was not surprised to find Kadash inside. The Ardent was moving some ledgers and books from a wall safe into a pack on the floor. On a desk nearby, a span reed scribbled. Dalinar stepped into the room. The scarred Ardent jumped, then relaxed when he saw it was Dalinar. "Do we need to have this conversation again, Dalinar?" he asked, turning back to his packing. "No," Dalinar said. "I didn't actually come looking for you. I want to find a man who lived here, a madman who claimed to be one of the heralds." Kadash cocked his head. "Ah, yes. The one who had a shard blade? All of the other patients at the monastery are accounted for, safe at Urethiru, but he vanished somehow. I was hoping to see if his room offered any clues to what became of him." Kadash looked at him, gauging his sincerity. Then the Ardent sighed, rising. "That's a different devotary from mine," he said. "But I have occupancy records here. I should be able to tell you which room he was in." "Thank you." Kadash looked through a stack of ledgers. "Shash building," he finally said, pointing absently out the window. "That one right there, room 37. Insa ran the facility. Her records will list details of the madman's treatment. If her departure from the war camp was anything like mine, she'll have left most of her paperwork behind." He gestured toward the safe and his packing. "Thank you," Dalinar said. He moved to leave. "You think the madman was actually a herald, don't you?"
"I think it's likely."
He spoke with a rural Alethi accent, Dalinar. "And he looks Makabaki," Dalinar replied.
"That alone is an oddity, wouldn't you say?
Immigrant families are not so uncommon. Ones with shard blades?" Kadash shrugged.
"Let's say I could actually find one of the heralds," Dalinar said. "Let's say we could confirm his identity and you accepted that proof. Would you believe him if he told you the same things I have?"
Kadash sighed.
"Surely you'd want to know if the Almighty were dead, Kadash," Dalinar said, stepping back into the room. "Tell me you wouldn't."
"You know what it would mean? It would mean there is no spiritual basis for your rule."
"I know."
"And the things you did in conquering Alethkar," Kadash said. "No divine mandate, Dalinar." Everyone accepts what you did because your victories were proof of the Almighty's favor. Without him, then what are you? Tell me, Kadash, would you really rather not know?
Kadash looked at the span reed, which had stopped writing. He shook his head.
I don't know, Dalinar. It certainly would be easier. Isn't that the problem? What has any of this ever required of men like me? What has it required of any of us?
It required you to be what you are, which is self-fulfilling, Dalinar said.
You were a swordsman, Kadash. Would you have gotten better without opponents to face? Would you have gotten stronger without weights to lift? Well, in Boronism, we've spent centuries avoiding the opponents and the weights.
Again, Kadash glanced at the span reed.
What is it? Dalinar asked.
I left most of my span reeds behind, Kadash explained, when I went with you toward the center of the Shattered Plains. I took only the span reed linked to an ardent transfer station in Kolinar. I thought that would be enough, but it no longer works. I've been forced to use intermediaries in Tashik.
Kadash lifted a box onto the desk and opened it. Inside were 5 more span reeds with blinking rubies indicating that someone had been trying to contact Kadash.
These are linked to the leaders of Voronism in Yarkaved, Erdaz, Karbranth, Thelana, and New Natnan, Kadash said, counting them off.
They had a meeting via reeds today discussing the nature of the desolation in the Everstorm. And perhaps you. I mentioned I was going to recover my own span reeds today. Apparently their meeting has made them all very eager to question me further.
He let the silence hang between them, measured out by the 5 blinking red lights.
What of the one that is writing? Dalinar asked.
Aligned to the Palinaeum and the heads of Voron Research there. They've been working on the Dawn Chant using the clues Brightness Navani gave them from your visions. What they've sent me are relevant passages from ongoing translations.
Proof, Dalinar said. You wanted solid proof that what I've been seeing is real.
He strode forward, grabbing Kadash by the shoulders.
You waited for that reed first before answering the leaders of Voronism?
I wanted all the facts in hand.
So you know that the visions are real?
I long ago accepted that you weren't mad. These days it's more a question of who might be influencing you.
Why would the Voidbringers give me these visions? Dalinar said. Why would they grant us great powers like the one that flew us here? It's not rational, Kadash.
Neither is what you're saying about the Almighty. He held up a hand to cut off Dalinar.
I don't want to have this argument again. Before you asked me for proof that we are following the Almighty's precepts, right?
All I asked for and all I want is the truth.
We have it already. I'll show you.
I look forward to it, Dalinar said, walking to the door. But Kadash, in my painful experience, the truth may be simple, but it is rarely easy.
Dalinar crossed to the next building over and counted down the rooms.
Storms, this building felt like a prison.
Most of the doors hung open, revealing uniform chambers beyond. Each had one tiny window, a slab for a bed, and a thick wooden door. The Ardents knew what was best for the sick. They had access to all the world's latest research in all fields. But was it really necessary to lock madmen away like this? Number 37 was still bolted shut. Dalinar rattled the door, then threw his shoulder against it.
Storms, it was thick.
Without thinking, he put his hand to the side and tried summoning his shard blade. Nothing happened.
What are you doing?
The Stormfather demanded.
Sorry,
Dalinar said, shaking his hand out. Habit. He crouched down and tried peeking under the door, then called out, suddenly horrified by the idea that they might have simply left the man in here to starve. That couldn't have happened, could it?
My powers, Dalinar said, rising. Can I use them?
Binding things, the Stormfather said. How would that open a door? You are a bondsmith,
You bring things together. You do not divide them.
And my other surge, Dalinar said. That radiant in the vision made stone warp and ripple.
You are not ready. Besides, that surge is different for you than it is for a stone ward.
Well, from what Dalinar could see underneath the door, there seemed to be light in this room. Perhaps it had a window to the outside he could use. On his way out, he poked through the ardent chambers until he found an office like Kadash's. He didn't find any keys, though the desk still had pens and ink sitting on it. They'd left in haste, so there was a good chance the wall safe contained records. But of course, Dalinar couldn't get in. Storms, he missed having a shard blade. He rounded the outside of the building to check the window, then immediately felt silly for spending so much time trying to get through the door. Somebody else had already cut a hole in the stone out here, using the distinctive clean slices of a shard blade. Dalinar stepped inside, picking his way around the broken remnants of the wall which had fallen inward, indicating that the shard-bearer had cut from the outside. He found no madman. The Ardens had likely seen this hole and moved on with their evacuation. News of the strange hole must not have filtered up to the lead Ardens. He didn't find anything to indicate where the Herald had gone, but at least he knew a shard-bearer was involved. Someone powerful had wandered into this room, which lent even more credence to the madman's claims of being a Herald. So who had taken him? Or had they done something to him instead? What happened to a Herald's body when they died? Could someone else have come to the same conclusion that Jasnah had? As he was about to leave, Dalinar spotted something on the ground beside the bed. He knelt down, shooed away a kremling, and picked up a small object. It was a dart, green with yellow twine, wrapped around it. He frowned, turning it over in his fingers. Then he looked up as he heard someone distantly calling his name. He found Kaladin out in the monastery courtyard calling for him. Dalinar approached, then handed in the little dart.
Ever seen anything like this before, Captain?
Kaladin shook his head. He sniffed at the tip, then raised his eyebrows. That's poison on the tip. Blackbane derived.
Are you sure?
Dalinar asked, taking the dart back.
Very. Where did you find it?
In the chamber that housed the Herald.
Kaladin grunted.
You need more time for your search?
Not much, Dalinar said. Though it would help if you'd summon your shard blade.
A short time later, Dalinar handed Navani the records he'd taken from the Arden's safe. He dropped the dart in a pouch and handed it over as well, warning her about the poisoned tip. One by one, Kaladin sent them into the sky, where his bridgemen caught them and used stormlight to stabilize them. Dalinar was last, and as Kaladin reached for him, he took the captain by the arm.
You want to practice flying in front of a storm, Dalinar said. Could you get to Thalinar?
Probably, Kaladin said, if I lashed myself southward as fast as I can go.
Go then, Dalinar said. Take someone with you to test flying another person in front of a storm if you want. But get to Thalin City. Queen Fenn is willing to join us, and I want that Oathgate active. The world has been turning before our very noses, Captain. Gods and heralds have been warring, and we were too focused on our petty problems to even notice.
I'll go next Highstone, Kaladin said,
then sent Dalinar soaring up into the air. 51. Full Circle. This is all we will say at this time. If you wish more, seek these waters in person and overcome the tests we have created. Only in this will you earn our respect. The Parshman of Moash's new sledge crew didn't like him. That didn't bother him. Lately, he didn't much like himself. He didn't expect or need their admiration. He knew what it felt like to be beaten down, despised. When you'd been treated as they had, you didn't trust someone like Moash. You asked yourself what he was trying to get from you. After a few days of pulling their sledge, the landscape began to change. the open plains became cultivated hills. They passed great sweeping wards, artificial stone ridges, built by planting sturdy wooden barricades to collect creme during storms. The creme would harden, slowly building up a mound on the stormward side. After a few years, you raised the top of the barricade. They took generations to grow to useful sizes, but here, around the oldest, most populated centers of Alethkar, they were common. They looked like frozen waves of stone, stiff and straight on the western side, sloping and smooth on the other side. In their shadows, vast orchards spread in rows, most of the trees cultivated to grow no more than the height of a man. The western edge of those orchards was ragged with broken trees. Barriers would need to be erected to the west as well now. He expected the fused to burn the orchards, but they didn't. During a water break, Moash studied one of them. A tall woman who hovered a dozen feet in the air, toes pointed downward. Her face was more angular than those of the parshman. She resembled a spren the way she hung there, an impression accented by her flowing clothing. Moash leaned back against his sledge and took a pull on his waterskin. Nearby, an overseer watched him and the parshman of his crew. She was new, a replacement for the one he'd punched. A few more of the fused passed on horses, trotting the beasts with obvious familiarity. "That variety doesn't fly," he thought. "They can raise the darklight around themselves, but it doesn't give them lashings. Something else." He glanced back at the one nearest him, the one hovering. "But that type almost never walks. It's the same kind that captured me." Kaladin wouldn't have been able to stay aloft as long as these did. He'd run out of stormlight. "She's studying those orchards," Moash thought. "She looks impressed." She turned in the air and soared off, long clothing rippling behind her. Those overlong robes would have been impractical for anyone else, but for a creature who almost always flew, the effect was mesmerizing. "This isn't what I was supposed to be like," Moash said. Nearby, one of the parshmen of his crew grunted.
"Tell me about it, human."
Moash glanced at the man who had settled down in the shade of their lumber-laden sledge. The parshman was tall, with rough hands, mostly dark skin, marbled with lines of red. The others had called him Sa, a simple Alethi Dark Eyes name. Moash nodded his chin toward the Voidbringers. "They were supposed to sweep in relentlessly, destroying everything in their path. They are literally incarnations of destruction."
"And?"
Saw asked. "And that one," Moash said, pointing toward the flying Voidbringer, "is pleased to find these orchards here. They only burned a few towns. They seem intent on keeping Revelar working it." Moash shook his head. "This was supposed to be an apocalypse, but you don't farm an apocalypse."
Saw grunted again.
He didn't seem to know any more about this than Moash did, but why should he? He'd grown up in a rural community in Alethkar. Everything he knew about history and religion, he'd have heard filtered through the human perspective.
"You shouldn't speak so casually about the fused human," Saw said, standing up. "They're dangerous."
"Don't know about that," Moash said, as two more passed overhead. "The one I killed went down easy enough, though I don't think she was expecting me to be able to fight back." He handed his waterskin to the overseer as she came around for them. Then he glanced at Saw, who was staring at him, slack-jawed. "Probably shouldn't have mentioned killing one of their gods," Moash thought, walking to his place in line, last, closest to the sledge, so he stared at a sweaty parshman back all day. They started up again, and Moash expected another long day's work. These orchards meant Kolinar itself was a little over a day's hike away at an easy pace. He figured the Voidbringers would push them hard to reach the capital by nightfall. He was surprised, then, when the army diverged from the direct route. They wove between some hillsides until they reached a town, one of the many suburbs of Kolinar. He couldn't recall the name. The tavern had been nice and welcoming to caravaneers. Clearly, there were other Voidbringer armies moving through Alethkar, because they'd obviously seized this city days, if not weeks ago. Parshman patrolled it, and the only humans he saw were already working the fields. Once the army arrived, the Voidbringers surprised Moash again by selecting some of the wagon pullers and setting them free. They were the weaklings, the ones who had fared worst on the road. The overseers sent them trudging toward Kolinar, which was still too far off to see.
They're trying to burden the city with refugees, Moash thought. Ones that aren't fit to work or fight anymore.
The main bulk of the army moved into the large storm bunkers in this suburb. They wouldn't attack the city immediately. The Voidbringers would rest their armies, prepare, and besiege. In his youth, he'd wondered why there weren't any suburbs closer than a day's walk from Kolinar. In fact, there was nothing between its walls and here, only empty flats. Even the hills there had been mined down centuries ago. The purpose was clear to him now. If you wanted to lay siege to Kolinar, this was the closest you could put your army. You couldn't camp in the city's shadow. You'd be swept away by the first storm. In the town, the supply sledges were split, some sent down one street, which looked hauntingly empty to him, while his went down another. They actually passed the tavern he'd preferred, the Fallen Tower. He could see the glyph etched into the leeward stone. Finally, his crew was called to a halt, and he let go of the rope, stretching his hands and letting out a relieved sigh. They'd been sent to a large open ground near some warehouses where Parshmen were cutting lumber.
A lumber yard?
He thought, then felt stupid. After hauling wood all this way, what else would he expect? Still, a lumber yard. Like those back in the war camps. He started laughing.
Don't be so jovial, human, spat one of the overseers. You're to spend the next few weeks working here, building siege equipment. When the assault happens, you'll be at the front, running a ladder toward Kolinar's infamous walls.
Moash laughed even harder. It consumed him, shook him. He couldn't stop. He laughed helplessly until, short of breath, he dizzily lay back on the hard stone ground, tears leaking down the sides of his face.
"We have investigated this woman," Moraes' newest letter to Shallan read. "Ishna has overinflated her importance to you. She was indeed involved in espionage for House Hammaradin, as she told you, but she was merely an assistant to the true spies. We have determined that she is safe to allow close to you, though her loyalties should not be trusted too far. If you eliminate her, we will help cover up the disappearance, at your request. But we have no objection to you retaining her services." Shallan sighed, settling back in her seat, where she waited outside King Elokar's audience chamber. She'd found this paper unexpectedly in her satchel. So much for hoping Ishna had information about the ghost bloods she could use. The letter practically boiled with possessiveness. They would allow Ishna to be close to her? Storms, they acted like they owned her already. She shook her head, then rummaged in her satchel, taking out a small sphere pouch. It would look unremarkable to anyone inspecting it, for they wouldn't know that she'd transformed it with a small but simple illusion. Though it appeared violet, it was actually white. The interesting thing about it was not the illusion itself, but how she was powering it. She'd practiced before with attaching an illusion to pattern, or to a location, but she'd always needed to power it with her own stormlight. This one, however, she'd attached to a sphere inside the pouch. She was going on 4 hours now, with the light weaving needing no extra stormlight from her. She'd needed only to create it, then affix it to the sphere. Slowly, the light had been draining from the sapphire mark, just like a fabrial draining its gemstone. She'd even left the pouch alone in her rooms when going out, and the illusion had still been in place when she'd returned. This had begun as an experiment on how she could help Dalinar create his illusory maps of the world then leave them for him without her having to remain in the meeting. Now, however, she was seeing all kinds of possible applications. The door opened, and she dropped the pouch back into her satchel. A master servant ushered a few merchants out of the king's presence. Then the servant bowed to Shallan, waving her in. She stepped hesitantly into the audience chamber, a room in Urethiru with a fine blue and green rug and stuffed with furniture. Diamonds shone from lamps, and Elokar had ordered the walls painted, obscuring the strata. The king himself, in a blue Kolin uniform, was unrolling a map onto a large table at the side of the room. "Was there another, Helt?" he asked the master servant. "I thought I was done for the—" He trailed off as he turned. "Brightness, Shallan! Were you waiting out there? You could have seen me immediately." "I didn't want to be a bother," Shallan said, stepping over to him as the master servant prepared refreshment. The map on the table showed Kolinar, a grand city, which seemed every bit as impressive as Vaidenar. Papers in a pile beside it looked to have the final reports from Spanreads in the city, and a wizened Ardent sat near them, ready to read for the king or take notes at his request. "I think we're almost ready," the king said, noting her interest. "The delay has been nearly insufferable, but requisite, I'm sure. Captain Kaladin did want to practice flying other people before bringing my royal person. I can respect that." "He's asked me to fly with him above the storm to Thalen City," Shallan said, "to open the oath gate there. He's overly worried about dropping people, but if he does that to me, I'll have stormlight of my own and should survive the fall."
"Excellent," Elokar said. "Yes, a fine solution. But then you didn't come here to talk about this. What is your request of me?"
"Actually," Shallan said, "could I talk to you in private for a moment, Your Majesty?" He frowned, but then ordered his people to step out into the hallway. When two guards from Bridge 13 hesitated, the king was firm.
"She's a knight radiant," he said. "What do you think is going to happen to me?"
They filed out, leaving the two of them beside Elokar's table. Shallan took a deep breath, then changed her face. Not to that of Vale or Radiant, not one of her secrets, but instead to an illusion of Adolin. It was still surprisingly uncomfortable for her to do it in front of someone. She'd still been telling most people that she was of the Elsecallers like Yasna, so they wouldn't know of her ability to become other people. Elokar jumped.
"Ah," he said. "Ah, that's right."
"Your Majesty," Shallan said, changing her face and body to look like that of a cleaning woman she'd sketched earlier. "I'm worried that your mission will not be as simple as you think. The letters out of Kolinar, the last ones they'd gotten, were frightened, worried things. They spoke of riots, of darkness, of Spren taking form and hurting people." Shallan changed her face to that of a soldier. "I've been preparing a team of spies," she explained, "specializing in infiltration and information gathering. I've been keeping my focus quiet, for obvious reasons. I would like to offer my services for your mission."
"I'm not certain," Elokar said hesitantly. "If Dalinar would want me taking two of his radiants away from him."
"I'm not accomplishing much for him sitting around here," Shallan said, still wearing the soldier's face. "Besides, is it his mission, or is it yours?"
"My mission," the king said, then hesitated. "But let's not fool ourselves. If he didn't want you to go, I am not his subject," she said.
"Nor yours yet. I'm my own woman. You tell me. What happens if you get to Kolinar and the Oath Gate is held by the enemy? Are you going to let the bridge man just fight his way in? Or might there be a better option?" She changed her face to that of a Parsh woman she had from her older sketches. Elokar nodded, walking around her.
"A team, you say? Of spies? Interesting. A short time later, Shallan left the room carrying, tucked into her safe pouch, a formal royal request to Dalinar for Shallan's aid on the mission. Kaladin had said he felt comfortable bringing 6 people, other than a few bridgemen, who could fly on their own. Adolin and Elokar would leave room for 4 others. She tucked Elokar's request into her safe pouch, beside the letter from Marais. I just need to be away from this place, Shallan thought. I need to be away from them and from Yasna, at least until I can figure out what I want. A part of her knew what she was doing. It was getting harder to hide things in the back of her mind and ignore them, now that she'd spoken ideals. Instead, she was fleeing. But she could help the group going to Kolinar, and it did feel exciting, the idea of going to the city and finding the secrets there. She wasn't only running. She'd also be helping Adolin reclaim his home. Pattern hummed from her skirts, and she hummed along with him.
52. After his father. 18.5 years ago. Dalinar plodded back into camp so tired he suspected only the energy of his plate was keeping him upright. Each muggy breath inside his helm fogged the metal, which, as always, went somewhat transparent from the inside when you engaged the visor. He'd crushed the Hardassians, sending them back to start a civil war, securing the Alethi lands to the north and claiming the island of Akak. Now he'd moved southward to engage the Vadens at the border. Herdaz had taken far longer than Dalinar had expected. He'd been out on campaign a total of 4 years now. 4 glorious years. Dalinar walked straight to his armorer's tent, picking up attendants and messengers along the way. When he'd ignored their questions, they trailed after him like kremlings eyeing a great shell's kill, waiting for their moment to snatch a tidbit. Inside the tent, he extended his arms to the sides and let the armorers start the disassembly. Helm, then arms, revealing the gambeson he wore for padding. The helm's removal exposed sweaty, clammy skin that made the air feel too cold. The breastplate was cracked along the left side, and the armorers buzzed, discussing the repair, as if they had to do something other than merely give the plate stormlight and let it regrow itself. Eventually, all that remained were his boots, which he stepped out of, maintaining a martial posture by pure force of will. Without the support of his plate, exhaustion spren began to shoot up around him like jets of dust. He stepped over to a set of travel cushions and sat down, reclining against them, sighing and closing his eyes.
"Bright Lord," one of the armorers asked, "that's where we sit."
"This is now my audience tent," Dalinar said, not opening his eyes. "Take what is absolutely essential and leave me."
The clanking of armor stopped as the workers digested what he'd said. They left in a whispering rush, and nobody else bothered him for a blissful 5 minutes, until footfalls sounded nearby. Tent flaps rustled, then leather scrunched as someone knelt beside him.
"The final battle report is here, Bright Lord," Kadash's voice.
Of course it would be one of his storming officers. Dalinar had trained them far too well.
"Speak,"
Dalinar said, opening his eyes. Kadash had reached middle age, maybe 2 or 3 years older than Dalinar. He now had a twisting scar across his face and head from where a spear had hit him.
"We completely routed them, Bright Lord," Kadash said. "Our archers and light infantry followed with an extended harry. We slew, by best count, 2,000. Nearly half. We could have gotten more if we'd boxed them into the south."
"Never box in an enemy, Kadash," Dalinar said. "You want them to be able to retreat, or they'll fight you worse for it. A rout will serve us better than an extermination. How many people did we lose?"
"Barely 200.
Dalinar nodded. "Minimal losses, while delivering a devastating blow."
"Sir," Kadash said, "I'd say this raiding group is done for.
We've still got many more to dig out. This will last years yet.
Unless the Vaden send in an entire army and engage us in force.
They won't,
Dalinar said, rubbing his forehead.
Their king is too shrewd. It isn't full-on war he wants. He only wanted to see if any contested land had suddenly become uncontested.
Yes, Brightlord.
Thank you for the report. Now get out of here, and post some storming guards at the front so I can rest. Don't let anyone in, not even the Night Watcher herself.
Yes, sir. Kadash crossed the tent to the flaps.
Sir? You were incredible out there. Like a tempest.
Dalinar just closed his eyes and leaned back, fully determined to fall asleep in his clothing. Sleep, unfortunately, refused to come. The report set his mind to considering implications. His army had only one soulcaster for emergencies, which meant supply trains. These borderlands were expansive, hilly, and the Vadens had better generals than the Herdazians. Defeating a mobile enemy was going to be hard in such circumstances, as this first battle proved. It would take planning, maneuvering, and skirmish after skirmish to pin the various groups of Vadens down and bring them into proper battle. He yearned for those early days when their fights had been more rowdy, less coordinated. Well, he wasn't a youth anymore, and he'd learned in Herdaz that he no longer had Gavilar to do the hard parts of this job. Dalinar had camps to supply, men to feed, and logistics to work out. This was almost as bad as being back in the city, listening to scribes talk about sewage disposal. Save for one difference. Out here, he had a reward. At the end of all the planning, the strategy, and the debates with generals, came the thrill. In fact, through his exhaustion, he was surprised to find that he could sense it still. Deep down, like the warmth of a rock that had known a recent fire. He was glad that the fighting had dragged on all these years. He was glad that the Herdazians had tried to seize that land, and that now the Vadens wanted to test him. He was glad that other High Princes weren't sending aid, but waiting to see what he could accomplish on his own. Most of all, he was glad that, despite today's important battle, the conflict was not over. Storms, he loved this feeling. Today hundreds had tried to bring him down, and he'd left them ashen and broken. Outside his tent, people demanding his attention were turned away one after another. He tried not to feel pleasure each time. He would answer their questions eventually, just not now. Thoughts finally released their grip on his brain, and he dipped toward slumber, until one unexpected voice jerked him out of it and sent him bolting upright. That was Evie. He leapt to his feet. The thrill surged again within him, drawn out of its own slumber. Dalinar ripped open the tent's front flaps and gaped at the blonde-haired woman standing outside, wearing a Borin haba, but with sturdy walking boots sticking out below.
"Ah," Evie said, "husband."
She looked him up and down, and her expression soured, lips puckering.
"Has no person seen fit to order him a bath? Where are his grooms, to see him undressed properly?"
"Why are you here?" Dalinar demanded.
He hadn't intended to roar it, but he was so tired, so shocked. Evie leaned backward before the outburst, eyes opening wide. He briefly felt a spike of shame. But why should he? This was his war camp. Here he was the Blackthorn. This was the place where his domestic life should have no purchase on him. By coming here, she invaded that.
Evie said. Other women are at the camp. Other wives. It is common for women to go to war.
Alethi women, Dalinar snapped, trained to it from childhood and acquainted with the ways of warfare. We spoke of this, Evie, we...
He halted, looking at the guards. They shuffled uncomfortably.
"Come inside, Evie," Dalinar said. "Let's discuss this in private."
"Very well. And the children?"
"You brought our children to the battlefront?"
storms, she didn't even have the sense to leave them at the town the army was using as a long-term command post.
In,
Delinar said, pointing at the tent. Evie wilted, then scuttled to obey, cringing as she passed him. Why had she come? Hadn't he just been back to Kolinar to visit?
That had been recent, he was sure.
Or maybe not so recent. He did have several letters from Evie that Teleb's wife had read to him, with several more waiting to be read. He dropped the flaps back into position and turned toward Evie, determined not to let his frayed patience rule him.
"Navani said I should come," Evie said. "She said it was shameful that you have waited so long between visits. Adolin has gone over a year without seeing you, Dalinar, and little Renarin has never even met his father."
"Renarin," Dalinar said, trying to work out the name. He hadn't picked that.
Re, Evie said, "from my language. Nar, after his father. In, to be born unto."
"Stormfather, that was a butchering of the language," Dalinar fumbled, trying to work through it. "Nar meant like unto."
"What does re mean in your language?" Dalinar asked, scratching his face. "It has no meaning," Evie said. "It is simply the name. It means our son's name, or him."
Dalinar groaned softly. So the child's name was like one who was born unto himself.
Delightful. "You didn't answer," Evie pointed out, "when I asked after a name via Spanreed."
How had Navani and Iole allowed this travesty of a name? Storms. Knowing those two, they'd probably encouraged it. They were always trying to get Evie to be more forceful. He moved to get something to drink, but then remembered that this wasn't actually his tent. There wasn't anything in here to drink but armor oil.
"You shouldn't have come," Dalinar said. "It is dangerous out here." "I wish to be a more Alethi wife. I want you to want me to be with you."
He winced.
"Well, you should still not have brought the children."
Dalinar slumped down into the cushions.
"They are heirs to the princedom, assuming this plan of Gavilar's with the crown lands and his own throne works out. They need to remain safe in Kolinar." "I thought you'd want to see them,"
Evie said, stepping up to him. Despite his harsh words, she unbuckled the top of his gambeson to get her hands under it and begin rubbing his shoulders. It felt wonderful. He let his anger melt away. It would be good to have a wife with him, to scribe, as was proper. He just wished that he didn't feel so guilty at seeing her. He was not the man she wanted him to be.
"I hear you had a great victory today," Evie said softly. "You do service to the king."
"You'd have hated it, Evie. I killed hundreds of people. If you stay, you'll have to listen to war reports, accounts of deaths, many at my hand."
She was silent for a time.
"Could you not let them surrender to you?"
"The Vadens aren't here to surrender. They're here to test us on the battlefield."
"And the individual men? Do they care for such reasoning as they die?"
"What? Would you like me to stop and ask each man to surrender as I prepare to strike him down?"
"Would that—"
"No, Evie, that wouldn't work."
"Oh."
He stood up, suddenly anxious.
"Let's see the boys, then."
Leaving his tent and crossing the camp was a slog, his feet feeling like they'd been encased in blocks of creme. He didn't dare slouch. He always tried to present a strong image for the men and women of the army, but he couldn't help that his padded garb was wrinkled and stained with sweat. The land here was lush compared to Kolinar. The thick grass was broken by sturdy stands of trees, and tangled vines draped the western cliff faces. There were places farther into Yarkoved where you couldn't take a step without vines writhing under your feet. The boys were by Evie's wagons. Little Adolin was terrorizing one of the chawls, perched atop its shell and swinging a wooden sword about, showing off for several of the guards, who dutifully complimented his moves.
He'd somehow assembled armor from strings and bits of broken rockbud shell.
Storms he's grown, Dalinar thought.
When last he'd seen Adolin, the child had still looked like a toddler, stumbling through his words. Little over a year later, the boy spoke clearly and dramatically as he described his fallen enemies. They were apparently evil flying chulls. He stopped when he saw Dalinar, then he glanced at Evie. She nodded, and the child scrambled down from the chull. Dalinar was certain he'd fall at three different points. He got down safely, walked over, and saluted. Evie beamed.
He asked the best way to talk to you, she whispered. I told him you were a general, the leader of all the soldiers. He came up with that on his own.
Dalinar squatted down. Little Adolin immediately shied back, reaching for his mother's skirts.
Afraid of me? Dalinar asked. Not unwise. I'm a dangerous man.
Daddy?
The boy said, holding to the skirt with one white-knuckled hand, but not hiding.
Yes. Don't you remember me?
Hesitantly, the motley-haired boy nodded.
I remember you. We talk about you every night when we burn prayers. So you will be safe, fighting bad men.
I'd prefer to be safe from the good ones, too, Dalinar said, though I will take what I am offered.
He stood up, feeling... what? Shame to not have seen the boy as often as he should have? Pride at how the boy was growing? The thrill still squirming deep down. How had it not dissipated since the battle?
Where is your brother, Adolin? Dalinar asked.
The boy pointed toward a nurse who carried a little one. Dalinar had expected a baby, but this child could nearly walk, as evidenced by the nurse putting him down and watching fondly as he toddled a few steps, then sat, trying to grab blades of grass as they pulled away. The child made no sounds. He just stared, solemn, as he tried to grip blade after blade. Dalinar waited for the excitement he'd felt before upon meeting Adolin for the first time. But storms. He was just so tired.
Can I see your sword?
Adolin asked. Dalinar wanted nothing more than to sleep, but he summoned the blade anyway, driving it into the ground with the edge pointed away from Adolin. The boy's eyes grew wide.
Mommy says I can't have my plate yet, Adolin said.
Teleb needs it. You can have it when you come of age.
Good. I'll need it to win a blade.
Nearby, Evie clicked her tongue softly, shaking her head. Dalinar smiled, kneeling beside his blade and resting his hand on the boy's shoulder.
I'll win you one in war, son.
No,
Adolin said, chin up.
I want to win my own, like you did.
A worthy goal, Dalinar said. But a soldier needs to be willing to accept help. You mustn't be hard-headed. Pride doesn't win battles.
The boy cocked his head, frowning.
Your head isn't hard?
He rapped his knuckles against his own. Dalinar smiled, then stood up and dismissed Oathbringer. The last embers of the thrill finally faded.
It's been a long day, he told Evie. I need to rest. We'll discuss your role here later.
Evie led him to a bed within one of her storm wagons. Then, at last, Dalinar was able to sleep.
Alethi Glyphs, page 1. My friend, the secrets uncovered infiltrating the Calligrapher's Guild are more mundane than expected. I prefer bloodstains to inkstains any day, so next time send me somewhere I'm more likely to die from wounds than from hand cramps. By purities, if you ask me to draw another glyph... The darkest secret of the guild is that the phonemes within a glyph can sometimes be deciphered. Sorry to shatter your theories of dark rites and ancient moon dances, But glyphs aren't pronounced or read. They're memorized, and they change over time till the original collection of phonograms is almost unrecognizable. Take, for instance, the glyph for storm, Zerus. High, Ketcha. High storm, Kazeris. Eternal, Kalad. Everstorm, Kalazeris. Contrast Zerus with a glyph in its infancy, Zatalef, a bat-like cephalopod the Alethi hadn't encountered until their recent conquests in Akak. The glyph's phonemes are apparent as well as the glyph's resemblance to the actual creature. Glyphs have simplified versions for small writing. Glyph pairs are slightly more common than single glyphs. Less used are three glyphs in a row. Even older than Zerus are the glyphs used in the first oath of the Knights Radiant. Yavani Tebel Tzameth, Katav Tebel Kadalak, Melak Tebel Maviz. These resemble more the complex, unreadable glyphs representing the orders of knights than they do any middle or modern Alethi glyphs. I suspect these were borrowed from an earlier source and incorporated into an already developing Alethi glyph lexicon. This supports the claim that Alethi glyphs were adopted from older scripts, likely descended from Dawn Chant, and might explain the two sets of phonemes used in glyph creation, standard and calligraphic. Glyph makers use both, the phonemes rotated, flipped, and distorted, to fit the calligrapher's vision. Next page, the calligraphic phoneme set.
53. Such a twisted cut. Friend, your letter is most intriguing, even revelatory. The ancient Silm dynasty in Yakeved had been founded after the death of King Nanchet. No contemporary accounts survived. The best they had dated from 2 centuries later. The author of that text, Natata Ved, often called Oil Eyes by her contemporaries, insisted that her methods were rigorous, although by modern standards, historical scholarship had been in its infancy. Yasna had long been interested in Nanchet's death because he'd ruled for only 3 months. He'd succeeded to the throne when the previous king, his brother Nanhar, had taken ill and died while on campaign in what would become modern Triax. Remarkably, during the brief span of his reign, Nanchet survived 6 assassination attempts. The first had come from his sister, who had wanted to place her husband on the throne. After surviving poisoning, Nanchet had put them both to death. Soon after, their son had tried to kill him in his bed. Nanchet, apparently a light sleeper, struck down his nephew with his own sword. Nanchet's cousin tried next. That attack left Nanchet blinded in one eye, and was followed by another brother, an uncle, and finally Nanchet's own son. At the end of 3 exasperating months, according to Oil Eyes, the great but weary Nanchet called for an accounting of all his household. He gathered them together at a grand feast, promising the delights of distant Eomia. Instead, when all were assembled, Nanchet had them executed one by one. Their bodies were burned in a grand pyre, upon which was cooked the meat for the feast that he ate alone at a table set for 200. Natata Oil Eyes was known to have had a passion for the dramatic. The text sounded almost delighted when she'd explained how he died by choking on the food at that very feast, alone, with nobody to help him. Similar tales repeated themselves throughout the long history of the Vorin lands. Kings fell, and their brothers or sons took the throne. Even a pretender of no true lineage would usually claim kinship through oblique and creative genealogical justifications. Yasna was simultaneously fascinated and worried by these accounts. Thoughts about them were unusually present in her mind as she made her way into Urethiru's basement. Something in her readings the night before had lodged this particular story in her brain. She soon peeked into the former library beneath Urethiru. Both rooms, one on either side of the hallway that led to the crystal pillar, were filled with scholars now, occupying tables carried down by squads of soldiers. Dalinar had sent expeditions down the tunnel the Unmaid had used to flee. The scouts reported a long network of caverns. Following a stream of water, they'd marched for days, and eventually located an exit into the mountain foothills of Tufalia. It was nice to know that, in a pinch, there was another way out of Urethiru, and a potential means of supply, other than through the Oath Gates. They maintained guards in the upper tunnels, and for now it seemed safe enough in the basement. Therefore, Navani had transformed the area into a scholarly institute designed to solve Dalinar's problems and to provide an edge in information, technology, and pure research. Concentration spren rippled in the air like waves overhead, a rarity in Alethkar, but common here, and logic spren darted through them like tiny storm clouds. Yasna couldn't help but smile. For over a decade, she'd dreamed of uniting the best minds of the kingdom in a coordinated effort. She'd been ignored. All anyone had wanted to discuss was her lack of belief in their god. Well, they were focused now. Turned out that the end of the world had to actually arrive before people would take it seriously. Renarin was there, standing near the corner, watching the work. He'd been joining the scholars with some regularity, but he still wore his uniform with the Bridge 4 patch. "You can't spend forever floating between worlds, cousin," she thought. "Eventually you'll need to decide where you want to belong." Life was so much harder, but potentially so much more fulfilling, when you found the courage to choose. The story of the old Vaden king, Nanhet, had taught Yasna something troubling. Often, the greatest threat to a ruling family was its own members. Why were so many of the old royal lines such knots of murder, greed, and infighting? And what made the few unique exceptions different? She'd grown adept at protecting her family against danger from without, carefully removing would-be deposers. But what could she do to protect it from within? In her absence already, the monarchy trembled. Her brother and her uncle, who she knew loved each other deeply, ground their wills against one another like mismatched gears. She would not have her family implode. If Alethkar was going to survive the desolation, they'd need committed leadership, a stable throne. She entered the library room and walked to her writing stand. It was in a position where she could survey the others and have her back to a wall. She unpacked her satchel, setting up two span reed boards. One of the reeds was blinking early, and she twisted the ruby, indicating she was ready. A message came back, writing out, "We will begin in 5 minutes." She passed the time scrutinizing the various groups in the room, reading the lips of those she could see, absently taking notes in shorthand. She moved from conversation to conversation, gleaning a little from each one, and noting the names of the people who spoke. "Tests confirm something is different here. Temperatures are distinctly lower on other nearby peaks of the same elevation. We have to assume that Bright Lord Colin is not going to return to the faith. What then?" "Don't know. Perhaps if we could find a way to conjoin the Fabrials, we could imitate this effect."
"The boy could be a powerful addition to our ranks. He shows interest in numerology, and asked me if we can truly predict events with it. I will speak with him again."
That last one was from the Storm Wardens. Yasna tightly pursed her lips.
"Ivory," she whispered, "I will watch them."
He left her side, shrunken to the size of a speck of dust. Yasna made a note to speak to Renarin. She would not have him wasting his time with a bunch of fools who thought they could foretell the future based on the curls of smoke from a snuffed candle. Finally, her span reed woke up. "I have connected Jochi of Thelena and Ethid of Aesir for you, Brightness.
Here are their passcodes. Further entries will be strictly their notations. Excellent, Yasna wrote back, authenticating the two passcodes. Losing her span reeds in the sinking of the wind's pleasure had been a huge setback. She could no longer directly contact important colleagues or informants. Fortunately, Tashik was set up to deal with these kinds of situations. You could always buy new reeds connected to the Princeton's infamous information centers. You could reach anyone in practice, so long as you trusted an intermediary. Yasna had one of those she'd personally interviewed, and whom she paid good money to ensure confidentiality. The intermediary would burn her copies of this conversation afterward. The system was as secure as Yasna could make it, all things considered. Yasna's intermediary would now be joined by two others in Tashik. Together the three would be surrounded by six spanreed boards, one each for receiving comments from their masters, and one each to send back the entire conversation in real time, including the comments from the other two. That way, each conversant would be able to see a constant stream of comments without having to stop and wait before replying. Navani talked of ways to improve the experience, of span reads that could be adjusted to connect to different people. That was one area of scholarship, however, that Yasna did not have time to pursue. Her receiving board started to fill with notes written by her two colleagues. "Yasna, you live," Jochi wrote. "Back from the dead. Remarkable." "I can't believe you ever thought she was dead," Ethid replied. "Yasna Kolin? Lost at sea? Likelier we'd find the Stormfather dead." "Your confidence is comforting, Ethid," Yasna wrote on her sending board. A moment later, those words were copied by her scribe into the common spanreed conversation. "Are you at Irithiru?" Jochi wrote. "When can I visit?" "As soon as you're willing to let everyone know you aren't female," Yasna wrote back. Jochi, known to the world as a dynamic woman of distinctive philosophy, was a pen name for a pot-bellied man in his 60s who ran a pastry shop in Thalen City. "Oh, I'm certain your wonderful city has need of pastries," Jochi wrote back jovially. "Can we please discuss your silliness later?" Ethid wrote. "I have news." She was a scion, a kind of religious order of scribe, at the Azish Royal Palace.
"Well, stop wasting time, then," Jochi wrote. "I love news. Goes excellently with a filled donut. No, a fluffy brioche."
"The news?" Yasna just wrote, smiling. These two had studied with her under the same master. They were Veristatalians of the keenest mind, regardless of how Jochi might seem.
"I've been tracking a man we are increasingly certain is the Herald Naku, the judge," Ethid wrote. "Nalan, as you call him."
"Oh, are we sharing nursery tales now?" Jochi asked. "Heralds? Really, Ethid?"
"If you haven't noticed," Ethid wrote, "the Voidbringers are back. Tales we dismissed are worth a second look now."
"I agree," Yasna wrote. "But what makes you think you found one of the Heralds?"
"It's a combination of many things," she wrote. "This man attacked our palace, Yasna. He tried to kill some thieves. The new Prime is one of them. But keep that in your sleeve. We're doing what we can to play up his common roots while ignoring the fact that he was intent on robbing us."
"Harold's alive and trying to kill people," Jochi wrote. "And here I thought my news about a sighting of Axes the Collector was interesting."
"There's more," Ethid wrote. "Yes, now we've got a Radiant here. An Edge Dancer, or we had one."
"Had one?" Jochi wrote. "Did you misplace her?"
"She ran off. She's just a kid, Yasna. Reshi, raised on the streets."
"I think we may have met her," Yasna wrote.
My uncle encountered someone interesting in one of his recent visions. I'm surprised you let her get away from you.
Have you ever tried to hold on to an edge dancer? Ethid wrote back. She chased after the Herald to Tashik, but the Prime says she is back now and avoiding me. In any case, something's wrong with the man I think is Nalan, Yasna. I don't think the Heralds will be a resource to us.
I will provide you with sketches of the Heralds, Yasna said. I have drawings of their true faces provided by an unexpected source. Ethid, you are right about them. They aren't going to be a resource. They're broken. Have you read the accounts of my uncle's visions?
I have copies somewhere, Ethid wrote. Are they real? Most sources agree that he's unwell.
He's quite well, I assure you, Yasna wrote. The visions are related to his Order of Radiance. I will send you the latest few. They have relevance to the Heralds.
Storms, Ethid wrote. The Blackthorn is actually a radiant? Years of drought, and now they're popping up like rock buds.
Ethid did not think highly of men who earned their reputations through conquest, despite having made the study of such men a cornerstone of her research. The conversation continued for some time. Jochi, growing uncharacteristically solemn, spoke directly of the state of Thelena. It had been hit hard by the repeated coming of the Everstorm. Entire sections of Thelen's city were in ruin. Yasna was most interested in the Thelen Parshmen who had stolen the ships that had survived the storm. Their exodus, combined with Kaladin Stormblessed's interactions with the Parshmen in Alethkar, was painting a new picture of what and who the Voidbringers were. The conversation moved on as Ethid transcribed an interesting account she'd discovered in an old book discussing the desolations. From there, they spoke of the Dawn Chant translations, in particular some ardents in Yakaved who were ahead of the scholars at Karbranth. Yasna glanced through the library room, seeking out her mother, who was sitting near Shallan to discuss wedding preparations. Renarin still lurked at the far side of the room, mumbling to himself, or perhaps to his spren. She absently read his lips.
"It's coming from in here," Renarin said. "Somewhere in this room."
Yasna narrowed her eyes. "Ethid," she wrote, "weren't you going to try to construct drawings of the spren tied to each Order of Radiant?"
"I've gotten quite far, actually," she wrote back. "I saw the Edge Dancer spren personally after demanding a glimpse."
"What of the Truth Watchers?" Yasna wrote.
"Oh, I found a reference to those," Jochi wrote. "The spren reportedly looked like light on a surface after it reflects through something crystalline." Yasna thought for a moment, then briefly excused herself from the conversation. Jochi said he needed to go find a privy anyway. She slipped off her seat and crossed the room, passing near Navani and Shallan.
"I don't want to push you at all, dear," Navani was saying. "But in these uncertain times, surely you wish for stability?"
Yasna stopped, free hand resting idly on Shallan's shoulder. The younger woman perked up, then followed Yasna's gaze toward Renarin.
"What?" Shallan whispered. "I don't know," Yasna said. "Something odd."
Something about the way the youth was standing, the words he had spoken. He still looked wrong to her without his spectacles, like a different person entirely.
"Yasna," Shallan said, suddenly tense.
"The doorway, look." Yasna sucked in stormlight at the girl's tone and turned away from Renarin toward the room's doorway. There, a tall, square-jawed man had darkened the opening. He wore Sadeus's colors, forest green and white. In fact, he was Sadeus now, at least its regent. Yasna would always know him as Meridas Amaram.
"What's he doing here?" Shallan hissed.
"He's a high prince," Navani said. "The soldiers aren't going to forbid him without a direct command." Amram fixated on Yasna with regal, light tan eyes. He strode toward her, exuding confidence. Or was it conceit?
"Yasna," he said when he drew close. "I was told I could find you here."
"Remind me to find whoever told you," Yasna said, "and have them hanged." Amram stiffened.
"Could we speak together more privately, just for a moment?"
"I think not."
"We need to discuss your uncle. The rift between our houses serves nobody. I wish to bridge that chasm, and Dalinar listens to you. Please, Yasna, you can steer him properly."
"My uncle knows his own mind on these matters and doesn't require me to steer him."
"As if you haven't been doing so already, Yasna. Everyone can see that he has started to share your religious beliefs."
"Which would be incredible since I don't have religious beliefs." Amram sighed, looking around.
"Please," he said. "Private?"
"Not a chance, Meridas."
"Go away. We were close once."
"My father wished us to be close. Do not mistake his fancies for fact."
"Yasna,
you really should leave before somebody gets hurt." He ignored her suggestion, glancing at Navani and Shallan, then stepping closer.
"We thought you were dead. I needed to see for myself that you are well."
"You have seen. Now leave." Instead, he gripped her forearm.
"Why, Yasna? Why have you always denied me?"
"Other than the fact that you are a detestable buffoon who achieves only the lowest level of mediocrity, as it is the best your limited mind can imagine, I can't possibly think of a reason."
"Mediocre," Amram growled. "You insult my mother, Yasna. You know how hard she worked to raise me to be the best soldier this kingdom has ever known."
"Yes. From what I understand, she spent the 7 months she was with child entertaining each and every military man she could find in the hopes that something of them would stick to you." Meridas's eyes widened, and his face flushed deeply. To their side, Shallan audibly gasped.
"You godless whore,"
Amram hissed, releasing her.
"If you weren't a woman..."
"If I weren't a woman, I suspect we wouldn't be having this conversation. Unless I were a pig. Then you'd be doubly interested."
He thrust his hand to the side, stepping back, preparing to summon his blade.
Yasna smiled, holding her free hand toward him, letting stormlight curl and rise from it. "Oh, please do, Meridas. Give me an excuse, I dare you." He stared at her hand. The entire room had gone silent, of course. He'd forced her to make a spectacle. His eyes flicked up to meet hers. Then he spun and stalked from the room, shoulders hunched as if trying to shrug away the eyes and the snickers of the scholars. "He will be trouble," Yasna thought. "Even more than he has been." Amram genuinely thought he was Alethkar's only hope and salvation, and had a keen desire to prove it. Left alone, he'd rip the armies apart to justify his inflated opinion of himself. She'd speak with Dalinar. Perhaps the two of them could devise something to keep Amram safely occupied. And if that didn't work, she wouldn't speak to Dalinar about the other precautions she would take. She'd been out of touch for a long time, but she was confident there would be assassins for hire here, ones who knew her reputation for discretion and excellent pay. A high-pitched sound came from beside her, and Yasna glanced to find Shallan sitting perkily on her seat, making an excited noise in the back of her throat and clapping her hands together quickly, the sound muffled by her clothed safe hand. "Wonderful." "Mother," Yasna said, "might I speak for a moment with my ward?" Navani nodded, her eyes lingering on the doorway where Amram had exited. Once she'd pushed for the union between them. Yasna didn't blame her. The truth of Amram was difficult to see, and had been even more so in the past, when he'd been close to Yasna's father. Navani withdrew, leaving Shallan alone at the table stacked with reports.
"Brightness," Shallan said as Yasna sat. "That was incredible!"
I let myself be pushed into abundant emotion.
"You are so clever!"
And yet my first insult was not to attack him, but the moral reputation of his female relative. Clever? Or simply the use of an obvious bludgeon?
Well,
regardless, Yasna cut in, wishing to avoid further conversation about Amram. "I've been thinking about your training." Shallan stiffened immediately.
"I've been very busy, Brightness. However, I'm sure I'll be able to get to those books you assigned me very soon."
Yasna rubbed her forehead.
"This girl."
"Brightness," Shallan said.
"I think I might have to request a leave from my studies."
Shallan spoke so quickly, the words ran into one another.
"His Majesty says he needs me to go with him on the expedition to Kolinar."
Yasna frowned.
"Kolinar?
Nonsense. They'll have the Wind Runner with them. Why do they need you?"
"The king is worried they might need to sneak into the city," Shallan said. "Or even through the middle of it, if it's occupied. We can't know how far the siege has progressed. If Elokar has to reach the Oath Gate without being recognized, then my illusions will be invaluable. I have to go. It's so inconvenient. I'm sorry."
She took a deep breath, eyes wide, as if afraid that Yasna would snap at her.
"This girl."
"I'll speak with Elokar," Yasna said. "I feel that might be extreme. For now, I want you to do drawings of Renarin's and Kaladin's spren, for scholarly reasons. Bring them to me for—" She trailed off.
"What is he doing?"
Renarin stood near the far wall, which was covered in palm-sized tiles. He tapped a specific one and somehow made it pop out, like a drawer. Yasna stood, throwing back her chair. She strode across the room, Shallan scampering along behind her. Renarin glanced at them, then held up what he'd found in the small drawer. A ruby, long as Yasna's thumb, cut into a strange shape with holes drilled in it.
"What on Roshar?"
She took it from him and held it up.
"What is it?"
Navani said, shouldering up beside her.
"A fabril?
No metal parts. What is that shape?" Yasna reluctantly surrendered it to her mother.
"So many imperfections in the cut," Navani said. "That will cause it to lose stormlight quickly. It won't even hold a charge for a day, I bet. And it will vibrate something fierce."
"Curious." Yasna touched it, infusing the gemstone with stormlight. It started glowing, but not nearly as brightly as it should have. Navani was, of course, right. It vibrated as stormlight curled off it. Why would anyone spoil a gem with such a twisted cut? And why hide it? The small drawer was latched with a spring, but she couldn't see how Renarin had gotten it undone.
"Storms," Shallan whispered as other scholars crowded around. "That's a pattern."
"A pattern?"
"Buzzes in sequence," Shallan said. "My spren says he thinks this is a code."
"Letters?"
"Music of language," Renarin whispered.
He drew in stormlight from some spheres in his pocket, then turned and pressed his hands against the wall, sending a surge of stormlight through it that extended from his palms like twin ripples on the surface of a pond. Drawers slid open, one behind each white tile. 100, 200, each revealing gemstones inside. The library had decayed, but the ancient radiance had obviously anticipated that. They'd found another way to pass on their knowledge.
54. An Ancient Singer's Name.
I would have thought, before attaining my current station, that a deity could not be surprised. Obviously, that is not true. I can be surprised. I can perhaps even be naive, I think.
I'm just asking, Ken grumbled. How is this any better? We were slaves under the Alethi. Now we're slaves under the Fused. Great! It does me so much good to know that our misery is now at the hands of our own people.
The Parsh woman set her bundle down with a rattling thump.
You'll get us in trouble again talking like that, Saw said.
He dropped his bundle of wooden poles, then walked back the other way. Moash followed, passing rows of humans and Parshmen turning the poles into ladders. These, like Saw and the rest of his team, would soon be carrying those ladders into battle, facing down a storm of arrows. What a strange echo of his life months ago in Satius's war camp. Except here, he'd been given sturdy gloves, a nice pair of boots, and 3 solid meals a day. The only thing wrong with the situation, other than the fact that he and the others would soon be charging a fortified position, was that he had too much free time. The workers hauled stacks of wood from one part of the lumberyard to the next, and were occasionally assigned to saw or chop. But there wasn't enough to keep them busy. That was a very bad thing, as he'd learned on the Shattered Plains. Give condemned men too much time, and they'd start to ask questions.
Look, Ken said, walking next to Saw just ahead. At least tell me you're angry, Saw. Don't tell me you think we deserve this.
We harbored a spy, Saw muttered.
A spy that Moash had quickly learned had been none other than Kaladin Stormblast.
Like a bunch of slaves should be able to spot a spy, Hen said. Really? Shouldn't the Spren have been the one to spot him? It's like they wanted something to pin on us.
Like it's a setup? Moash asked from behind.
Yeah, a setup,
Hen agreed. They did that a lot, forgetting words. Or maybe they were simply trying the words out for the first time. Their accent was so similar to that of many of the bridgemen who had been Moash's friends.
Let go, Moash, something deep within him whispered. Give up your pain. It's all right. You did what was natural. You can't be blamed. Stop carrying that burden. Let go.
They each picked up another bundle and began walking back. They passed the carpenters who were making the ladder poles. Most of these were Parshmen, and one of the Fused walked among their ranks. He was a head taller than the Parshmen, and was a subspecies that grew large proportions of carapace armor in wicked shapes. The Fused stopped, then explained something to one of the working Parshmen. The Fused made a fist, and dark violet energy surrounded his arm. Carapace grew there into the shape of a saw. The Fused sawed, carefully explaining what he did. Moash had seen this before. Some of these monsters from the void were carpenters. Out beyond the lumberyards, Parshmen troops practiced close-order drill and received basic weapon training. Word was that the army intended to assault Kolinar within weeks. That was ambitious, but they didn't have time for an extended siege. Kolinar had soulcasters to make food, while the Voidbringer operations in the country would take months to get going. This Voidbringer army would soon eat itself out of supplies and would have to divide up to forage. Better to attack, use overwhelming numbers, and seize the soulcasters for themselves. Every army needed someone to run at the front and soak up arrows. Well organized or not, benevolent or not, the Voidbringers couldn't avoid that. Moash's group wouldn't be trained. They were really only waiting until the assault so they could run in front of more valuable troops.
We were set up, Hen repeated as they walked. They knew they had too few humans strong enough to run the first assault. They need some of us in there. So they found a reason to toss us out to die.
Saw grunted.
Is that all you're going to say? Hen demanded.
Don't you care what our own gods are doing to us?
Sa slammed his bundle to the ground.
Yes, I care, Sa snapped. You think I haven't been asking the same questions? Storms, they took my daughter, Hen. They ripped her away from me and sent me off to die.
Then what do we do?
Hen asked, her voice growing small.
What do we do?
Sa looked around at the army moving and churning, preparing for war. Overwhelming, enveloping, like its own kind of storm, in motion and inexorable. The sort of thing that picked you up and carried you along.
I don't know, Sa whispered. Storms, Hen. I don't know anything.
I do, Moash thought, but he couldn't find the will to say anything to them. Instead, he found himself annoyed, anger spren boiling up around him. He felt frustrated both at himself and at the Voidbringers. He slammed his bundle down, but then stalked off, out of the lumberyard. An overseer yelped loudly and scuttled after him, but she didn't stop him, and neither did the guards he passed. He had a reputation. Moash strode through the city, tailed by the overseer, searching for one of the flying type of fused. They seemed to be in charge, even of the other fused. He couldn't find one, so he settled for approaching one of the other subspecies. A Malin that sat near the city's cistern, where rainwater collected. The creature was of the heavily armored type, with no hair, the carapace encroaching across his cheeks. Moash strode right up to the creature. I need to talk to someone in charge. Behind him, Moash's overseer gasped, perhaps only now realizing that whatever it was Moash was up to, it could get her in serious trouble. The fused regarded him and grinned. Someone in charge, Moash repeated. The Voidbringer laughed, then fell backward into the water of the cistern, where he floated, staring at the sky. Great, Moash thought. One of the crazy ones. There were many of those. Moash stalked away, but didn't get much farther into the town before something dropped from the sky. Cloth fluttered in the air, and in the middle of it floated a creature with skin that matched the black and red clothing. He couldn't tell if it was Malin or Femalin.
Little human, the creature said with a foreign accent. You are passionate and interesting.
Moash licked his lips.
I need to talk to someone in charge.
You need nothing but what we give you, the fused said. But your desire is to be granted. Lady Leshwe will see you.
Great. Where can I find her?
The fused pressed its hand against his chest and smiled. Dark void light spread from its hand across Moash's body. Both of them rose into the air. Panicking, Moash clutched at the fused. Could he get the creature into a chokehold? Then what? If he killed it up here, he'd drop to his own death. They rose until the town looked like a tiny model. Lumberyard and parade ground on one side, the single prominent street down the center. To the right, the man-made ward provided a buffer against the high storms, creating a shelter for trees and the city lord's mansion. They ascended even farther, the fused loose clothes fluttering. Though the air was warm at ground level, up here it was quite chilly, and Moash's ears felt odd, dull, as if they were stuffed with cloth. Finally, the fused slowed them to a hovering stop. Though Moash tried to hold on, the fused shoved him to the side, then zoomed away in a flaring roil of cloth. Moash drifted alone above the expansive landscape. His heart thundered, and he regarded that drop, realizing something. He did not want to die. He forced himself to twist and look about him. He felt a surge of hope as he found he was drifting toward another fused. A woman, who hovered in the sky, wearing robes that must have extended a good 10 feet below her, like a smear of red paint. Moash drifted right up beside her, getting so close that she was able to reach out and stop him. He resisted grabbing that arm and hanging on for dear life.
His mind was catching up to what was happening. She wanted to meet him, but in a realm where she belonged and he did not. Well, he would contain his fear.
"Moash," the fused said. Leshwi, the other had called her. She had a face that was all three Parshendi colors, white, red, and black, marbled like paint swirled together. He had rarely seen someone who was all three colors before, and this was one of the most transfixing patterns he'd seen, almost liquid in its effect, her eyes like pools around which the colors ran.
"How do you know my name?" Moash asked.
"Your overseer told me," Leshwi said.
She had a distinct serenity about her as she floated with feet down. The wind up here tugged at the ribbons she wore, pushing them backward in careless ripples. There were no wind spren in sight, oddly.
"Well, did you get that name?"
"My grandfather named me," Moash said, frowning. This was not how he'd anticipated this conversation going.
"Curious. Do you know that it is one of our names?"
"It is?" She nodded.
"How long has it drifted on the tides of time, passing from the lips of singers to men and back, to end up here on the head of a human slave?"
"Look, you're one of the leaders?"
"I'm one of the fused who is sane," she said, as if it were the same thing.
"Then I need to—"
"You're bold," Leshwi said, eyes forward. "Many of the singers we left here are not. We find them remarkable, considering how long they were abused by your people. But still, they are not bold enough."
She looked to him for the first time during the conversation. Her face was angular, with long flowing parchment hair, black and crimson, thicker than that of a human, almost like thin reeds or blades of grass. Her eyes were a deep red, like pools of shimmering blood.
"Where did you learn the surges, human?" she asked.
"The surges?"
"When you killed me," she said, "you were lashed to the sky, but you responded quickly with familiarity. I will say, without guile, that I was furious to be caught so unaware."
"Wait," Moash said, cold. "When I killed you?" She regarded him, unblinking with those ruby eyes. "You're the same one?" Moash asked. That pattern of marbled skin, he realized. It's the same as the one I fought. But the features were different.
"This is a new body offered to me in sacrifice," Leshwi said. "To bond and make my own, as I have none."
"You're some kind of spren?" She blinked, but did not reply. Moash started to drop. He felt it in his clothes, which lost their power to fly first. He cried out, reaching toward the fused woman, and she seized him by the wrist and injected him with more void light. It surged across his body, and he hovered again. The violet darkness retreated, visible again only as faint periodic crackles on her skin.
"My companion spared you," she said to him. "Brought you here to these lands as they thought I might wish personal vengeance once reborn. I did not. Why would I destroy that which had such passion? Instead, I watched you, curious to see what you did. I saw you help the singers who were pulling the sledges."
Moash took a deep breath. "Can you tell me, then, why you treat your own so poorly?"
"Poorly?" she said, sounding amused. "They are fed, clothed, and trained."
"Not all of them," Moash said. "You had those poor parchmen working as slaves, like humans.
and now you're going to throw them at the city walls.
Sacrifice, she said. Do you think an empire is built without sacrifice?
She swept her arm across the landscape before them. Moash's stomach turned over. He'd briefly been able to fixate only on her and forget exactly how high he was. Storms, this land was big. He could see extensive hills, plains, grass, trees, and stone in all directions. And in the direction she gestured, a dark line on the horizon. Kolinar?
I breathe again because of their sacrifices, Leshwe said. And this world will be ours because of sacrifice. Those who fall will be sung of, but their blood is ours to demand. If they survive the assault, if they prove themselves, then they will be honored.
She looked to him again.
You fought for them during the trip here.
Honestly, I expected you to have me killed for that.
If you were not killed for striking down one of the fused, she said, then why would you be killed for striking one of our lessers? In both cases, human. You proved your passion and earned your right to succeed. Then you bowed to authority when presented and earned your right to continue to live. Tell me, why did you protect those slaves?
Because you need to be unified, Moash said. He swallowed. My people don't deserve this land. We're broken, ruined, incapable.
She cocked her head. A cool wind played with her clothing.
And are you not angered that we took your shards?
They were first given me by a man I betrayed. I don't deserve them.
No, not you. It's not your fault. You aren't angry that we conquer you?
No.
Then what does anger you? What is your passionate fury, Moash, the man with an ancient singer's name?
Yes, it was still there, still burning deep down.
Stormit, Kaladin had been protecting a murderer.
Vengeance, he whispered. Yes, I understand.
She looked at him, smiling in what seemed to him a distinctly sinister way.
Do you know why we fight? Let me tell you.
A half hour later, as evening approached, Moash walked the streets of a conquered town. By himself. Lady Leshwe had ordered that Moash be left alone, freed. He walked with his hands in the pockets of his bridge forecoat, remembering the frigid air up above. He still felt chilled, even though down here it was muggy and warm. This was a nice town, quaint. Little stone buildings, plants growing at the backs of every house. On his left, that meant cultivated rock buds and bushes burst from around doors. But to his right, facing the storm, there were only blank stone walls, not even a window. The plants smelled of civilization to him, a sort of civic perfume that you didn't get out in the wilds. They barely quivered as he passed, though Lifespren bobbed at his presence. The plants were accustomed to people on the streets. He finally stopped at a low fence surrounding pens holding the horses the Voidbringers had captured. The animals munched cut grass the parchment had thrown to them. Such strange beasts. Hard to care for, expensive to keep. He turned from the horses and looked out over the fields toward Kolinar. She'd said he could leave, join the refugees making for the capital, defend the city.
What is your passionate fury?
Thousands of years being reborn? What would it be like? Thousands of years,
and they'd never given up. Prove yourself.
He turned and made his way back to the lumber yard where the workers were packing up for the day. There was no storm projected tonight, and they wouldn't have to secure everything, so they worked with a relaxed, almost jovial air. All save for his crew, who, as usual, gathered by themselves, ostracized. Moash seized a bundle of ladder rods off a pile. The workers there turned to object, but cut off when they saw who it was. He untied the bundle, and upon reaching the crew of unfortunate parshmen, tossed a length of wood to each one. Saw caught his and stood up, frowning. The others mimicked him.
"I can train you with those," Moash said.
"Sticks?" Chen asked.
"Spears," Moash said. "I can teach you to be soldiers. We'll probably die anyway. Stormit will probably never make it to the top of the walls. But it's something."
The parshmen looked at one another, holding rods that could mimic spears.
"I'll do it," Chen said.
Slowly, the others nodded in agreement. 55. Alone Together.
I am the least equipped of all to aid you in this endeavor. I am finding that the powers I hold are in such conflict that the most simple of actions can be difficult.
Relaine sat on the shattered plains alone and listened to the rhythms. Enslaved parshmen, deprived of true forms, weren't able to hear the rhythms. During his years spent as a spy, he'd adopted dull form, which heard them weakly. It had been so hard to be apart from them. They weren't quite true songs. They were beats with hints of tonality and harmony. He could attune one of several dozen to match his mood, or, conversely, to help alter his mood. His people had always assumed the humans were deaf to the rhythms. But he wasn't convinced. Perhaps it was his imagination, but it seemed that sometimes they responded to certain rhythms. They'd look up at a moment of frenzied beats, eyes getting a far-off look. They'd grow agitated and shout in time for a moment, to the rhythm of irritation, or whoop, right on beat with a rhythm of joy. It comforted him to think that they might someday learn to hear the rhythms. Perhaps then he wouldn't feel so alone. He currently attuned the rhythm of the lost, a quiet yet violent beat with sharp, separated notes. You attuned it to remember the fallen, and that felt the correct emotion as he sat here outside Narok watching humans build a fortress from what used to be his home. They set a watchpost atop the central spire, where the five had once met to discuss the future of his people. They turned homes into barracks. He was not offended. His own people had repurposed the ruins of Stormseat into Narok. No doubt these stately ruins would outlast the Alethi occupation, as they had the listeners. That knowledge did not prevent him from mourning. His people were gone now. Yes, parshmen had awakened, but they were not listeners. No more than Alethi and Vedans were the same nationality simply because most had similar skin tones. Relaine's people were gone. They had fallen to Alethi swords or had been consumed by the Everstorm, transformed into incarnations of the old listener gods. He was, as far as he knew, the last. He sighed, pulling himself to his feet. He swung a spear to his shoulder, the spear they let him carry. He loved the men of Bridge Four, but he was an oddity, even to them. The parshmen they allowed to be armed. The potential Voidbringer they had decided to trust, and wasn't he just so lucky? He crossed the plateau to where a group of them trained under Teft's watchful eye. They didn't wave to him. They often seemed surprised to find him there, as if they'd forgotten he was around. But when Teft did notice him, the man's smile was genuine. They were his friends. It was merely... How could Relaine be so fond of these men, yet at the same time want to slap them?
When he and Scar had been the only two who couldn't draw Stormlight, they'd encouraged Scar. They'd given him pep talks, told him to keep trying. They had believed in him. Relaine, though? Well, who knew what would happen if he could use Stormlight? Might it be the first step in turning him into a monster? Never mind that he'd told them you had to open yourself to a form to adopt it. Never mind that he had the power to choose for himself. Though they never spoke of it, he saw the truth in their reactions. As with Dabid, they thought it best that Relaine remain without Stormlight. The Parshman and the Insane Man. People you couldn't trust as Windrunners. 5 bridgemen launched into the air, radiant and streaming with light. Some of the crew trained, while another group patrolled with Kaladin, checking on caravans. A third group, the 10 other newcomers that had learned to draw in Stormlight, trained with Pete a few plateaus over. That group included Lynn and all 4 of the other scouts, along with 4 men from other bridge crews and a single light-eyed officer. Kolat, the archer captain. Lynn had slid into Bridge 4's camaraderie easily, as had a couple of the bridgemen. Relaine tried not to feel jealous that they almost seemed more a part of the team than he did. Teft led the 5 in the air through a formation while the 4 others strolled toward Rock's drink station. Relaine joined them, and Yake slapped him on the back, pointing toward the next plateau over where the bulk of the hopefuls continued to train.
"That group can barely hold a spear properly," Yake said. "You ought to go show them how a real bridgeman does a kata, eh, Relaine?" "Kalak help them if they have to fight those shellheads," F added, taking a drink from Rock. No offense, Relaine."
Relaine touched his head where he had carapace armor, distinctively thick and strong as he held Warform, covering his skull. It had stretched out his Bridge 4 tattoo, which had transferred to the carapace. He had protrusions on his arms and legs, too, and people always wanted to feel those. They couldn't believe they actually grew from his skin, and somehow thought it was appropriate to try to peek underneath.
"Relaine," Rock said, "is okay to throw things at Eth. He has hard head, too, almost like he has shell."
"It's all right," Relaine said, because that was what they expected him to say. He accidentally attuned irritation, though, and the rhythm laced his words. To cover his embarrassment, he attuned curiosity and tried Rock's drink of the day.
"This is good.
What is in it?"
"Ha! Is water I boiled kremlings in before serving them last night."
F spurted out his mouthful of drink, then looked at the cup, aghast.
"What?" Rock said. "You ate the kremlings easily."
"But this is like their bath water," F complained.
"Chilled," Rock said, "with spices. Is good taste."
"Is bath water," F said, imitating Rock's accent.
Teft led the other 4 in a streaking wave of light overhead. Relaine looked up and found himself attuning longing before he stomped it out. He attuned peace instead. Peace, yes. He could be peaceful.
"This isn't working," Drey said. "We can't storming patrol the entirety of the shattered plains. More caravans are going to get hit like that one last night." "The captain says it's strange for those Voidbringers to keep raiding like this," F said. "Tell that to the caravaneers from yesterday."
Yake shrugged.
"They didn't even burn much. We got there before the Voidbringers had time to do much more than frighten everyone. I'm with the captain. It's strange." "Maybe they're testing our abilities," F said. "Seeing what Bridge 4 can really do."
They glanced at Relaine for confirmation.
Am I supposed to be able to answer?" he asked.
"Well," F said, "I mean, storms, Relaine. They're your kinsmen. Surely you know something about them."
"You can guess, right?" Yake said.
Rock's daughter refilled his cup for him, and Relaine looked down at the clear liquid.
"Don't blame them," he thought. "They don't know. They don't understand."
Yes, Yeek, Relaine said carefully. My people did everything we could to separate ourselves from those creatures. We went into hiding long ago, and swore we would never accept forms of power again. I don't know what changed. My people must have been tricked somehow. In any case, these fused are as much my enemies as they are yours. More, even. And no, I can't say what they will do. I spent my entire life trying to avoid thinking of them.
Teft's group came crashing down to the plateau. For all his earlier difficulties, Scar had quickly taken to flight. His landing was the most graceful of the bunch. Hobber hit so hard he yelped. They jogged over to the watering station, where Rock's eldest daughter and son began giving them drinks. Relaine felt sorry for the two. They barely spoke Alethi, though the son, oddly, was Vorin. Apparently, monks came from Yakaved to preach the Almighty to the Horn-Eaters, and Rock let his children follow any god they wanted. So it was that the pale-skinned young Horn-Eater wore a glyph ward tied to his arm and burned prayers to the Vorin Almighty instead of making offerings to the Horn-Eater Spren. Relaine sipped his drink and wished Renarin were here. The quiet, light-eyed man usually made a point of speaking with Relaine. The others jabbered excitedly but didn't think to include him. Parshmen were invisible to them. They'd been brought up that way. And yet he loved them because they did try. When Scar bumped him and was reminded that he was there, he blinked, then said, "Maybe we should ask Relaine." The others immediately jumped in and said he didn't want to talk about it, giving a kind of Alethi version of what he'd told them earlier. He belonged here as much as he did anywhere else. Bridge 4 was his family, now that those from Narok were gone. Eshenai, Varanus, Thud. He attuned the rhythm of the lost and bowed his head. He had to believe that his friends in Bridge 4 could feel a hint of the rhythms, for otherwise how would they know how to mourn with true pain of soul? Teft was getting ready to take the other squad into the air when a group of dots in the sky announced the arrival of Kaladin Stormblessed. He landed with his squad, including Lopin, who juggled an uncut gemstone the size of a man's head. They must have found a chrysalis from a beast of the chasms.
"No sign of Voidbringers today," Leighton said, turning over one of Rock's buckets and using it as a seat. "What storms! The plains sure do seem smaller when you're up there."
"Yeah," Lopin said. "And bigger."
"Smaller and bigger?" Scar asked.
"Smaller," Leighton said, "because we can cross them so fast. I remember plateaus that felt like they took years to cross. We zip past those in an eye blink."
"But then you get up high," Lopin added, "and you realize how wide this place is. Sure how much of it we never even explored. And it just seems big."
The others nodded, eager. You had to read their emotion in their expressions and the way they moved, not in their voices. Maybe that was why emotion spren came so often to humans, more often than to listeners. Without the rhythms, men needed help understanding one another.
"Who's on the next patrol?" Scar asked. "None for today," Kaladin said. "I have a meeting with Dalinar. We'll leave a squad in Narok, but..."
Soon after he left through the Oath Gate, everyone would slowly start to lose their powers. They'd be gone in an hour or two. Kaladin had to be relatively near. Sigzil had placed their maximum distance from him at around 50 miles, though their abilities started to fade somewhere around 30 miles.
"Fine," Scar said. "I was looking forward to drinking more of Rock's Kremling juice anyway."
"Kremling juice?"
Sigzil said, drink halfway to his lips. Other than Relaine, Sigzil's dark brown skin was the most different from the rest of the crew, though the bridgemen didn't seem to care much about skin color. To them, only eyes mattered. Relaine had always found that strange, as among listeners, your skin patterns had at times been a matter of some import.
"So," Scar said, "are we going to talk about Renarin?"
The 28 men shared looks, many settling down around the barrel of Rock's drink as they once had around the cook fire. There were certainly a suspicious number of buckets to use as stools, as if Rock had planned for this. The horn eater himself leaned against the table he'd brought out for holding cups, a cleaning rag thrown over his shoulder. "What about him?" Kaladin asked, frowning and looking around at the group.
"He's been spending a lot of time with the scribes studying the Tower City," Nadam said.
"The other day," Scar added, "he was talking about what he's doing there. It sounded an awful lot like he was learning how to read."
The men shifted uncomfortably.
"So?" Kaladin asked. "What's the problem?"
"Sigzil can read his own language. Storm's eye can read glyphs."
"It's not the same," Scar said. "It's feminine," Drahi added.
"Drahi," Kaladin said,
"you are literally courting a man."
"So?"
Drahi said.
"Yeah. What are you saying, Cal?"
Scar snapped.
"Nothing. I just thought Drahi might empathize."
"That's hardly fair,"
Drahi said.
"Yeah," Lopin added. "Drahi likes other guys. That's like, he wants to be even less around women than the rest of us. It's the opposite of feminine. He is, you could say, extra manly."
"Yeah,"
Drahi said. Kaladin rubbed his forehead and Relaine empathized. It was sad that humans were so burdened by always being in mate form. They were always distracted by the emotions and passions of mating, and had not yet reached a place where they could put that aside. He felt embarrassed for them. They were simply too concerned about what a person should and shouldn't be doing. It was because they didn't have forms to change into. If Renarin wanted to be a scholar, let him be a scholar.
"I'm sorry," Kaladin said, holding out his hand to calm the men. "I wasn't trying to insult Drahi. But Storm's men, we know that things are changing. Look at the lot of us. We're halfway to being light eyes. We've already let 5 women into Bridge 4, and they'll be fighting with spears. Expectations are being upended, and we're the cause of it. So let's give Renarin a little leeway, shall we?"
Relaine nodded. Kaladin was a good man. For all his faults, he tried even more than the rest of them.
"I have thing to say," Rock added. "During last few weeks, how many of you have come to me saying you feel you don't fit in with Bridge 4 now?"
The plateau fell silent. Finally, Sigzil raised his hand, followed by Scar and several others, including Haber.
"Haber, you did not come to me," Rock noted.
"Oh, yeah, but I felt like it, Rock."
He glanced down.
"Everything's changing. I don't know if I can keep up."
"I still have nightmares," Layton said softly, "about what we saw in the bowels of Urethiru. Anyone else?"
"I have trouble with Lethe,"
Huio said.
"It makes me embarrassing. Alone."
"I'm scared of heights," Torfin added. "Flying up there is terrifying to me."
A few glanced at Teft.
"What?" Teft demanded. "You expect this to be a feeling-sharing party because the storming horn eater gave you a sour eye? Storm off! It's a miracle I'm not burning moss every moment of the day having to deal with you lot."
Nadam patted him on the shoulder.
"And I will not fight," Rock said. "I know some of you do not like this. He makes me feel different. Not only because I am only one with proper beard and crew."
He leaned forward.
"Life is changing. We will all feel alone because of this, yes? Ha! Perhaps we can feel alone together."
They all seemed to find this comforting. Well, except Lopin, who had snuck away from the group and for some reason was lifting up rocks on the other side of the plateau and looking underneath them. Even among humans, he was a strange one. The men relaxed and started to chat. Though Haber slapped Relaine on the back, it was the closest any of them came to asking how he felt. Was it childish of him to feel frustrated?
They all thought they were alone, did they? Felt that they were outsiders? Did they know what it was like to be of an entirely different species? A species they were currently at war with? A species whose people had all been either murdered or corrupted? People in the tower watched him with outright hatred. His friends didn't, but they sure did like to pat themselves on the back for the fact. "We understand that you're not like the others, Relaine. You can't help what you look like." He attuned annoyance and sat there until Kaladin sent the rest of them off to train the aspiring Windrunners. Kaladin spoke softly with Rock, then turned and paused, seeing Relaine sitting there on his bucket. "Relaine," Kaladin said, "why don't you take the rest of the day off?"
"What if I don't want special accommodation because you feel sorry for me?"
Kaladin squatted down beside Relaine.
"Hey, you heard what Rock said. I know how you feel. We can help you shoulder this."
"Do you really?"
Relaine said.
"Do you actually know how I feel, Kaladin Stormblessed? Or is that simply a thing that men say?"
"I guess it's a thing men say," Kaladin admitted, then pulled over an upside-down bucket for himself. "Can you tell me how it feels?"
Did he really want to know? Relaine considered, then attuned resolve.
"I can try."
56. Always with you. I am also made uncertain by your subterfuge. Why have you not made yourself known to me before this? How is it you can hide? Who are you truly? And how do you know so much about Edonalsium?
Dalinar appeared in the courtyard of a strange fortress with a single towering wall of blood-red stones. It closed a large gap in a mountainous rock formation. Around him, men carried supplies or otherwise made themselves busy, passing in and out of buildings constructed against the natural stone walls. Winter air made Dalinar's breath puff before him. He held Navani's free hand on his left and Yasna's on his right. It had worked. His control over these visions was increasing beyond even what the Stormfather assumed possible. Today, by holding their hands, he had brought Navani and Yasna in without a high storm.
"Wonderful," Navani said, squeezing his hand. "That wall is as majestic as you described. And the people. Bronze weapons again, very little steel."
"That armor is soul cast," Yasna said, releasing his hand. "Look at the finger marks on the metal. That's burnished iron, not true steel. Soul cast from clay into that shape. I wonder, did access to soul casters retard their drive to learn smelting? Working steel is difficult. You can't simply melt it over a fire like you can bronze."
"So," Dalinar asked, "when are we?"
"Maybe 2,000 years ago," Yasna said. "Those are Harovingian swords, and see those archways? Late classical architecture, but washed out faux blue on the cloaks rather than true blue dyes. Mix that with the language you spoke in, which my mother recorded last time, and I'm fairly certain."
She glanced at the passing soldiers.
"A multi-ethnic coalition here like during the Desolations. But if I'm right, this is over 2,000 years after Ahariatiam."
"They're fighting someone," Dalinar said. "The Radiants retreat from a battle, then abandon their weapons on the field outside."
"Which places the Recreants a little more recently than Mashadara Shaliv had it in her history," Yasna said, musing. "From my reading of your vision accounts, this is the last chronologically, though it's difficult to place the one with you overlooking ruined Kolinar."
"Who could they be fighting?"
Navani asked, as men atop the wall raised the alarm. Horsemen galloped out of the keep, off to investigate.
"This is well after the Voidbringers left."
"It could be the false desolation," Yasna said.
Dalinar and Navani both looked at her.
"A legend," Yasna said.
considered pseudo-historical. Defconte wrote an epic about it somewhere around 1,500 years ago. The claim is that some Voidbringers survived Ahar Etiam, and there were many clashes with them afterward. It's considered unreliable, but that's because many later Ardents insist that no Voidbringers could have survived. I'm inclined to assume this is a clash with Parshmen before they were somehow deprived of their ability to change forms. She looked at Dalinar, eyes alight, and he nodded. She strode off to collect whatever historical tidbits she could. Navani took some instruments from her satchel.
One way or another, I'm going to figure out where this Feverstone Keep is, even if I have to bully these people into drawing a map. Perhaps we could send scholars to this location and find clues about the recreants.
Dalinar made his way over to the base of the wall. It was a truly majestic structure, typical of the strange contrasts of these visions. A classical people, without fabrials or even proper metallurgy, accompanied by wonders. A group of men piled down the steps from the top of the wall. They were trailed by His Excellency Yonagon I, Prime Akasix of Aesir. While Dalinar had brought Navani and Yasna by touch, he had asked the Stormfather to bring in Yonagon. The high storm currently raged in Aesir. The youth saw Dalinar and stopped.
"Do I have to fight today, Blackthorn?"
"Not today, Your Excellency."
"I'm getting really tired of these visions," Yonagon said, descending the last few steps.
"That fatigue never leaves, Your Excellency. In fact, it has grown as I've begun to grasp the importance of what I have seen in vision, and the burden it puts upon me."
"That isn't what I meant by tired."
Dalinar didn't reply, hands clasped behind him as together they walked to the sally port, where Yonagon watched events unfold outside. Radiants were crossing the open plain or flying down. They summoned their blades, provoking concern from the watching soldiers. The knights drove their weapons into the ground, then abandoned them. They left their armor as well, shards of incalculable value renounced. The young emperor looked to be in no rush to confront them as Dalinar had been. Dalinar therefore took him by the arm and guided him out as the first soldiers opened the doors. He didn't want the emperor to get caught in the flood that would soon come, as men dashed for those blades, then started killing one another. As before in this vision, Dalinar felt as if he could hear the screaming deaths of the Spren, the terrible sorrow of this field. It almost overwhelmed him.
"Why?" Yonagon asked. "Why did they just give up?"
"We don't know, Your Excellency. This scene haunts me. There is so much I don't understand. Ignorance has become the theme of my rule." Yonagon looked around, then scrambled for a tall boulder to climb where he could better watch the radiance. He seemed far more engaged by this than he had been by other visions. Dalinar could respect that. War was war, but this was something you never saw. Men willingly giving up their shards? And that pain. It pervaded the air like a terrible stench. Yonagon settled down on his boulder.
"So why show me this? You don't even know what it means."
"If you're not going to join my coalition, I figure I should still give you as much knowledge as I can. Perhaps we will fall and you will survive. Maybe your scholars can solve these puzzles when we cannot. And maybe you are the leader Roshar needs while I am just an emissary."
"You don't believe that?"
"I don't. I still want you to have these visions, just in case." Yonagon fidgeted, playing with the tassels on his leather breastplate.
"I don't matter as much as you think I do."
"Pardon, Your Excellency, but you underestimate your importance. Aesir's Oathgate will be vital, and you are the strongest kingdom of the West. With Aesir at our side, many other countries will join with us."
"I mean," Yonagon said, "that I don't matter. Sure, Aesir does, but I'm only a kid they put on the throne because they were afraid that Assassin would come back."
And the miracle they're publishing? The proof from the heralds that you were chosen?
That was Lift, not me.
Yonagon looked down at his feet, swinging beneath him.
They're training me to act important, Colin. But I'm not. Not yet. Maybe not ever.
This was a new face to Yonagon. The vision today had shaken him, but not in the way Dalinar had hoped.
He's a youth, Dalinar reminded himself.
Life at his age was challenging anyway, without adding to it the stress of an unexpected accession to power.
Whatever the reason, Dalinar told the young emperor, you are prime. The viziers have published your miraculous elevation to the public. You do have some measure of authority.
He shrugged.
The viziers aren't bad people. They feel guilty for putting me in this position. They give me education, kind of force it down my throat, honestly, and expect me to participate. But I'm not ruling the Empire. They're scared of you. Very scared. More scared than they are of the assassin. He burned the Emperor's eyes, but emperors can be replaced. You represent something far more terrible. They think you could destroy our entire culture.
No Alethi has to set foot on Azish Stone, Dalinar said. But come to me, Your Excellency. Tell them you've seen visions that the heralds want you to at least visit Urethiru. Tell them that the opportunities far outweigh the danger of opening that oath gate.
And if this happens again?
Yonagon asked, nodding toward the field of shard blades, hundreds of them sprouting from the ground, silvery, reflecting sunlight. Men were now pouring out of the keep, flooding toward those weapons.
We will see that it doesn't. Somehow.
Dalinar narrowed his eyes.
I don't know what caused the recreants, but I can guess. They lost their vision, Your Excellency. They became embroiled in politics and let divisions creep among them. They forgot their purpose, protecting Roshar for its people.
Yonagon looked to him, frowning.
That's harsh. You always seemed so respectful of the Radiance before.
I respect those who fought in the Desolations. These? I can sympathize. I, too, have on occasion let myself be distracted by small-minded pettiness. But respect? No.
He shivered.
They killed their spren. They betrayed their oaths. They may not be villains, as history paints them. But in this moment they failed to do what was right and just. They failed Roshar.
The Stormfather rumbled in the distance, agreeing with this sentiment. Yonagon cocked his head.
What?
Dalinar asked.
Lift doesn't trust you, he said.
Dalinar glanced about, expecting her to appear as she had in the previous two visions he'd shown Yonagon. There was no sign of the young Reshi girl that the Stormfather detested so much.
It's because, Yonagon continued, you act so righteous. She says anyone who acts like you do is trying to hide something.
A soldier strode up and spoke to Yonagon in the Almighty's voice.
They are the first.
Dalinar stepped back, letting the young emperor listen as the Almighty gave his short speech for this vision. These events will go down in history. They will be infamous. You will have many names for what happened here. The Almighty said the same words he had to Dalinar. The night of sorrows will come and the true desolation, the Everstorm. The men on the field full of shards started to fight over the weapons. For the first time in history, men started slaughtering one another with dead spren. Finally, Yonagon faded, vanishing from the vision. Dalinar closed his eyes, feeling the Stormfather draw away. Everything now dissolved. Except it didn't. Dalinar opened his eyes. He was still on the field before the looming blood-red wall of Feverstone Keep. Men fought over shard blades while some voices called for everyone to be patient.
Those who claimed a shard this day would become rulers. It bothered Dalinar that the best men, the ones calling for moderation or raising concerns, would be rare among their numbers. They weren't aggressive enough to seize the advantage. Why was he still here? Last time the vision had ended before this.
"Stormfather?" he asked.
No reply. Dalinar turned around. A man in white and gold stood there. Dalinar jumped, scrambling backward. The man was old, with a wide, furrowed face and bone-white hair that swept back from his head as if blown by wind. Thick mustaches with a hint of black in them blended into a short white beard. He seemed to be Shin, judging by his skin and eyes, and he wore a golden crown in his powdery hair. Those eyes. They were ancient, the skin surrounding them deeply creased, and they danced with joy as he smiled at Dalinar and rested a golden scepter on his shoulder. Suddenly overwhelmed, Dalinar fell to his knees.
"I know you,"
he whispered.
You're him. God.
Yes, the man said.
Where have you been?
Dalinar said.
I've always been here, God said.
Always with you, Dalinar. Oh, I've watched you for a long, long time.
Here? You're not the Almighty, are you?
Honor? No.
He truly is dead, as you've been told.
The old man's smile deepened, genuine and kindly.
I'm the other one, Dalinar. They call me Odium.
57. Passion. If you would speak to me further, I request open honesty. Return to my lands, approach my servants, and I will see what I can do for your quest. Odium. Dalinar scrambled to his feet, lurching backward and seeking a weapon he didn't possess. Odium, standing in front of him. The Stormfather had grown distant, almost vanished, but Dalinar could sense a faint emotion from him. A whine, like he was straining against something heavy? No, that was a whimper. Odium rested his golden scepter against the palm of his hand, then turned to regard the men fighting over shard blades.
I remember this day, Odium said. Such passion. And such loss. Terrible for many, but glorious for others. You are wrong about why the Radiance fell, Dalinar. There was infighting among them, true, but no more than in other eras. They were honest men and women, with different views at times, but unified in their desire to do what was best.
What do you want of me? Dalinar said, hand to his breast, breathing quickly. Storms, he wasn't ready. Could he ever be ready for this moment? Odium strolled over to a small boulder and settled down. He sighed in relief, like a man releasing a heavy burden, then nodded to the space next to him. Dalinar made no move to sit.
You have been placed in a difficult position, my son, Odium said. You are the first to bond the Stormfather in his current state. Did you know that? You are deeply connected to the remnants of a god.
Whom you killed.
Yes. I'll kill the other one, too, eventually. She's hidden herself somewhere, and I'm too shackled.
You're a monster.
Oh, Dalinar. This from you, of all people? Tell me you've never found yourself in conflict with someone you respect. Tell me you've never killed a man because you had to, even if, in a better world,
he shouldn't deserve it?
Dalinar bit back a retort. Yes, he'd done that. Too many times.
I know you, Dalinar,
Odium said. He smiled again, a paternal expression.
Come, sit down. I won't devour you or burn you away at a touch.
Dalinar hesitated.
You need to hear what he says. Even this creature's lies can tell you more than a world of common truths.
He walked over, then stiffly sat down.
What do you know of us three?
Odium asked. Honestly, I wasn't even aware that there were three of you.
More, in fact,
Odium said absently.
But only three of relevance to you. Me, Honor, Cultivation. You speak of her, don't you?
I suppose, Dalinar said. Some people identify her with Roshar, the spren of the world itself.
She'd like that,
Odium said.
I wish I could simply let her have this place.
So do it. Leave us alone. Go away.
Odium turned to him so sharply that Dalinar jumped.
Is that, Odium said quietly, an offer to release me from my bonds, coming from the man holding the remnants of Honor's name and power?
Dalinar stammered.
Idiot, you're not some raw recruit. Pull yourself together.
No, he said firmly.
Ah, all right then,
Odium said. He smiled, a twinkle in his eyes.
Oh, don't fret so. These things must be done properly. I will go, if you release me, but only if you do it by intent.
And what are the consequences of releasing you?
Well, first I'd see to Cultivation's death. There would be other consequences, as you call them, as well.
Eyes burned as men swept about themselves with shard blades, killing others who had mere moments before been their comrades. It was a frantic, insane brawl for power.
And you can't just leave?
Dalinar asked.
Without killing anyone?
Well, let me ask you this in return. Why did you seize control of Alethkar from poor Elokar?
Don't reply. Don't give him ammunition.
You knew it was for the best,
Odium said.
You knew that Elokar was weak and the kingdom would suffer without firm leadership. You took control for the greater good, and it has served Roshar well.
Nearby, a man stumbled toward them, limping out of the fray. His eyes burned as a shard blade rammed through his back, protruding 3 feet out of his chest. He fell forward, eyes trailing twin lines of smoke.
A man cannot serve two gods at once, Dalinar,
Odium said.
And so I cannot leave her behind. In fact, I cannot leave behind the splinters of honor, as I once thought I could. I can already see that going wrong. Once you release me, my transformation of this realm will be substantial.
You think you'll do better?
Dalinar wet his mouth, which had gone dry.
Do better than others would for this land? You, a manifestation of hatred and pain?
They call me Odium,
the old man said.
A good enough name. It does have a certain bite to it. But the word is too limiting to describe me, and you should know that it is not all I represent.
Which is?
He looked to Dalinar.
Passion, Dalinar Kolin. I am emotion incarnate. I am the soul of the spren and of men. I am lust, joy, hatred, anger, and exultation. I am glory and I am vice. I am the very thing that makes men, men. Honor cared only for bonds,
Not the meaning of bonds and oaths, merely that they were kept. Cultivation only wants to see transformation, growth. It can be good or bad, for all she cares. The pain of men is nothing to her. Only I understand it. Only I care, Dalinar.
I don't believe that, Dalinar thought. I can't believe that.
The old man sighed, then heaved himself to his feet.
If you could see the result of Honor's influence, you would not be so quick to name me a god of anger. Separate the emotion from men, and you have creatures like Nail and his skybreakers. That is what Honor would have given you.
Dalinar nodded toward the terrible fray on the field before them.
You said I was wrong about what caused the Radiants to abandon their oaths. What was it really?
Odium smiled.
Passion, son. Glorious, wondrous passion. Emotion. It is what defines men, though ironically you are poor vessels for it. It fills you up and breaks you, unless you find someone to share the burden.
He looked toward the dying men.
But can you imagine a world without it?
No.
Not one I'd want to live in. Ask that of cultivation next time you see her. Ask what she'd want for Roshar. I think you'll find me to be the better choice.
Next time? Dalinar said.
I've never seen her.
Of course you have, Odium said, turning and walking away.
She simply robbed you of that memory. Her touch is not how I would have helped you. It stole a part of you away and left you like a blind man who can't remember that he once had sight.
Dalinar stood up.
I offer you a challenge of champions, with terms to be discussed. Will you accept it?
Odium stopped, then turned slowly.
Do you speak for the world, Dalinar Kolin? Will you offer this for all Roshar?
Storms, would he?
Either way, I don't accept.
Odium stood taller, smiling in an unnervingly understanding way.
I need not take on such a risk, for I know, Dalinar Kolin, that you will make the right decision. You will free me.
No,
Dalinar stood.
You shouldn't have revealed yourself, Odium. I once feared you, but it is easier to fear what you don't understand. I've seen you now, and I can fight you.
You've seen me, have you? Curious.
Odium smiled again. Then everything went white. Dalinar found himself standing on a speck of nothingness that was the entire world, looking up at an eternal, all-embracing flame. It stretched in every direction, starting as red, moving to orange, then changing to blazing white. Then somehow the flame seemed to burn into a deep blackness, violet and angry. This was something so terrible that it consumed light itself. It was hot. A radiance indescribable, intense heat and black fire, colored violet at the outside. Burning. Overwhelming. Power. It was the scream of 1,000 warriors on the battlefield. It was the moment of most sensual touch and ecstasy. It was the sorrow of loss, the joy of victory. And it was hatred. Deep, pulsing hatred, with a pressure to turn all things molten. It was the heat of 1,000 suns. It was the bliss of every kiss. It was the lives of all men wrapped up in one, defined by everything they felt. Even taking in the smallest fraction of it terrified Dalinar. It left him tiny and frail. He knew if he drank of that raw, concentrated liquid black fire, he'd be nothing in a moment. The entire planet of Roshar would puff away,
no more consequential than the curling smoke of a snuffed-out candle. It faded, and Dalinar found himself lying on the rock outside Feverstone Keep, staring upward. Above him, the sun seemed dim and cold. Everything felt frozen by contrast. Odium knelt down beside him, then helped him rise to a seated position.
"There, there. That was a smidge too much, wasn't it? I had forgotten how overwhelming that could be. Here, take a drink."
He handed Dalinar a water skin. Dalinar looked at it, baffled, then up at the old man. In Odium's eyes, he could see that violet-black fire. Deep, deep within. The figure with whom Dalinar spoke was not the god. It was merely a face. A mask. Because if Dalinar had to confront the true force behind those smiling eyes, he would go mad. Odium patted him on the shoulder.
"Take a minute, Dalinar. I'll leave you here. Relax. It..."
He cut off, then frowned, spinning. He searched the rocks.
"What?" Dalinar asked. "Nothing. Just an old man's mind playing tricks on him."
He patted Dalinar on the arm.
"We'll speak again, I promise."
He vanished in an eye blink. Dalinar collapsed backward, completely drained. Storms. Just storms.
"That guy," a girl's voice said, "is creepy."
Dalinar shifted, sitting up with difficulty. A head popped up from behind some nearby rocks. Tan skin, pale eyes, long dark hair, lean girlish features.
"I mean, old men are all creepy," Lift said. "Seriously. All wrinkly and, hey, want some sweets, and, oh, listen to this boring story. I'm on to them. They can act nice all they want, but nobody gets old without ruining a whole bunch of lives."
She climbed over the rocks. She wore fine Azish clothing now, compared to the simple trousers and shirt from last time. Colorful patterns on robes, a thick overcoat and cap.
"Even as old people go, that one was extra creepy," she said softly. "What was that thing, tight butt? Didn't smell like a real person."
"I call it odium," Dalinar said, exhausted. "And it is what we fight."
"Huh. Compared to that, you're nothing."
"Thank you."
She nodded as if it were a compliment.
"I'll talk to Gox. You got good food at that tower city of yours?"
"We can prepare some for you."
"Yeah, I don't care what you prepare. What do you eat? Is it good?"
Yes.
"Not military rations or some such nonsense, right?"
"Not usually."
"Great."
She looked at the place where Odium had vanished, then shivered visibly.
"We'll visit."
She paused, then poked him in the arm.
"Don't tell Gox about that odium thing, okay? He's got too many old people to worry about already."
Dalinar nodded. The bizarre girl vanished, and, moments later, the vision finally faded. The end of Part 2. Interludes. Kaza, Teravangian, Venli.
Interlude 4. Kaza. The ship First Dreams crashed through a wave, prompting Kaza to cling tightly to the rigging. Her gloved hands already ached, and she was certain each new wave would toss her overboard. She refused to go down below. This was her destiny. She was not a thing to be carted from place to place, not any longer. Besides, that dark sky, suddenly stormy, even though the sailing had been easy up until an hour ago, was no more disconcerting than her visions. Another wave sent water crashing across the deck. Sailors scrambled and screamed, mostly hirelings out of Steen, as no rational crew would make this trip. Captain Vazermeb stalked among them, shouting orders, while Draws, the helmsman, kept them on a steady heading, into the storm, straight into the storm. Kaza held tight, feeling her age as her arms started to weaken. Icy water washed over her, pushing back the hood of her robe, exposing her face and its twisted nature. Most sailors weren't paying attention, though her cry did bring Vazermeb's attention. The only Thalen on board, the captain didn't much match her image of the people. Thalens to her were portly little men in vests, merchants with styled hair, who haggled for every last sphere. Vazermeb, however, was as tall as an Alethi, with hands wide enough to palm boulders and forearms large enough to lift them. Over the crashing of waves, he yelled,
"Someone get that soul caster below deck!"
"No!" she shouted back at him.
"I stay!"
"I didn't pay a prince's ransom to bring you," he said, stalking up to her, "only to lose you over the side.
I'm not a thing to—"
"Captain!" a sailor shouted.
"Captain!"
They both looked as the ship tipped over the peak of a huge wave, then teetered, before just kind of falling over the other side. Storms! Kaza's stomach practically squeezed up into her throat, and she felt her fingers sliding on the ropes. Vazermeb seized her by the side of her robe, holding her tight as they plunged into the water beyond the wave. For a brief, terrifying moment, they seemed entombed in the chill water, as if the entire ship had sunk. The wave passed, and Kaza found herself lying in a sodden heap on the deck, held by the captain.
"Storming fool," he said to her. "You're my secret weapon. You drown yourself when you're not in my pay, understand?"
She nodded limply, and then realized with a shock she'd been able to hear him easily. The storm was gone. Vazermeb stood up straight, grinning broadly, his white eyebrows combed back into his long mane of dripping hair. All across the deck, the sailors who had survived were climbing to their feet, sopping wet and staring at the sky. It maintained its overcast gloom, but the winds had fallen completely still. Vazermeb bellowed out a laugh, sweeping back his long, curling hair.
"What did I tell you, men? That new storm came from Maemia. Now it has gone and escaped, leaving the riches of its homeland to be plundered."
Everyone knew you didn't linger around Aemia, though everyone had different explanations why. Some rumors told of a vengeful storm here, one that sought out and destroyed approaching ships, the strange wind they'd encountered, which didn't match the timing of High Storm or Everstorm, seemed to support that. The captain started shouting orders, getting the men back into position. They hadn't been sailing long, only a short distance out of Leofor, along the Shin coast, then westward toward this northern section of Aemia. They'd soon spotted the large main island, but had not visited it. Everyone knew that was barren, lifeless. The treasures were on the hidden islands, supposedly lying in wait to enrich those willing to brave the winds and treacherous straits. She cared less for that. What were riches to her? She had come because of another rumor, one spoken of only among her kind. Perhaps here, at last, she could find a cure for her condition. Even as she righted herself, she felt in her pouch, seeking the comforting touch of her soul caster. Hers, no matter what the rulers of Leofor claimed. Had they spent their youths caressing it, learning its secrets? Had they spent their middle years in service, stepping with each use closer and closer to oblivion? The common sailors gave Kaza space, refusing to look her in the eyes. She pulled her hood up, unaccustomed to the gaze of ordinary people. She'd entered the stage where her disfigurements were starkly obvious. Kaza was, slowly, becoming smoke. Vazermeb took the helm himself, giving Droz a break. The lanky man stepped down from the poop deck, noting her by the side of the ship. He grinned at her, which she found curious. She hadn't ever spoken to him. Now he sauntered over, as if intending to make small talk. "So," he said, "up on deck? Through that? You've got guts." She hesitated, considering this strange creature, then lowered her hood. He didn't flinch, even though her hair, her ears, and now parts of her face were disintegrating. There was a hole in her cheek through which you could see her jaw and teeth. Lines of smoke rimmed the hole. The flesh seemed to be burning away. Air passed through it when she spoke, altering her voice, and she had to tip her head all the way back to drink anything. Even then it dribbled out. The process was slow. She had a few years left until the soul casting killed her. Droz seemed intent on pretending nothing was wrong.
"I can't believe we got through that storm. You think it hunts ships? Like the stories say?"
He was Leoforan like herself, with deep brown skin and dark brown eyes. What did he want? She tried to remember the ordinary passions of human life, which she'd begun to forget.
"Is it sex you want? No, you are much younger than I am.
Curious.
Are you frightened and wishing for comfort?"
He started to fidget, playing with the end of a tied-off rope.
So, I mean, the prince sent you, right?"
"Ah, so he knew that she was the prince's cousin.
You wish to connect yourself to royalty? Well, I came on my own."
"Surely he let you go?"
"Of course he didn't. If not for my safety, then for that of my device." It was hers. She looked off across the too-still ocean. "They locked me up each day. Gave me comforts they assumed would keep me happy. They realized that at any moment I could literally make walls and bonds turn to smoke."
Does it hurt?"
"It is blissful. I slowly connect to the device and through it to Roshar, until the day it will take me fully into its embrace."
She lifted a hand and pulled her black glove off, one finger at a time, revealing a hand that was disintegrating. Five lines of darkness, one rising from the tip of each finger. She turned it, palm toward him.
"I could show you. Feel my touch, and you can know. One moment, and then you will mingle with the air itself."
He fled. "Excellent." The captain steered them toward a small island, poking from the placid ocean right where the captain's map had claimed it would be. It had dozens of names. The Rock of Secrets. The Void's Playground. So melodramatic. She preferred the old name for the place. Akina. Supposedly there had once been a grand city here. But who would put a city on an island you couldn't approach? For, jutting from the ocean here, were a set of strange rock formations. They ringed the entire island like a wall, each some 40 feet tall, resembling spearheads. As the ship drew closer, the sea grew choppy again, and she felt a bout of nausea. She liked that. It was a human feeling. Her hand again sought her soul caster. That nausea mixed with a faint sense of hunger. Food was something she often forgot about these days, as her body needed less of it now. Chewing was annoying, with the hole in her cheek. Still, she liked the scents from whatever the cook was stirring up below. Perhaps the meal would calm the men, who seemed agitated about approaching the island. Kaza moved to the poop deck, near the captain.
"Now you earn your keep, soul caster," he said. "And I'm justified in hauling you all the way out here."
"I'm not a thing," she said absently. "To be used. I am a person. Those spikes of stone, they were soul cast there."
The enormous stone spearheads were too even in a ring about the island. Judging by the currents ahead, some lurked beneath the waters as well, to rip up the hulls of approaching vessels.
Can you destroy one?
The captain asked her. No, they are much larger than you indicated. But I can make a hole in them, Captain. It is easier to soulcast an entire object. But I am no ordinary soulcaster. I have begun to see the dark sky and the second sun, the creatures that lurk, hidden, around the cities of men. He shivered visibly. Why should that have frightened him? She'd merely stated facts.
We need you to transform the tips of a few under the waves, he said. Then make a hole at least large enough for the dinghies to get into the island beyond.
I will keep my word, but you must remember, I do not serve you. I am here for my own purposes.
They dropped anchor as close to the spikes as they dared get. The spikes were even more daunting, and more obviously soulcast, from here. Each would have required several soulcasters in concert, she thought, standing at the prow of the ship, as the men ate a hasty meal of stew. The cook was a woman, Reshi from the looks of her, with tattoos all across her face. She pushed the captain to eat, claiming that if he went in hungry, he'd be distracted. Even Kaza took some, though her tongue no longer tasted food. It all felt like the same mush to her, and she ate with a napkin pressed to her cheek. The captain drew anticipation spren as he waited, ribbons that waved in the wind. And Kaza could see the beasts beyond, the creatures that accompanied the spren. The ship's four dinghies were cramped, with rowers and officers all together, but they made space for her at the front of one. She pulled up her hood, which still hadn't dried, and sat on her bench. What had the captain been planning to do if the storm hadn't stopped? Would he seriously have tried to use her and a dinghy to remove these spears in the middle of a tempest? They reached the first spike, and Kaza carefully unwrapped her soulcaster, releasing a flood of light. Three large gemstones connected by chains, with loops for her fingers. She put it on with the gemstones on the back of her hand. She sighed softly to feel the metal against her skin again. Warm, welcoming, a part of her. She reached over the side into the chill water and pressed her hand against the tip of the stone spear, smoothed from years in the ocean. Light from the gemstones lit the water, reflections dancing across her robe. She closed her eyes and felt the familiar sensation of being drawn into the other world, of another will reinforcing her own, something commanding and powerful, attracted by her request for aid. The stone did not wish to change. It was content with its long slumber in the ocean, but yes, yes, it remembered. It had once been air, until someone had locked it into this shape. She could not make it air again. Her soulcaster had only one mode, not the full three. She did not know why. Smoke, she whispered to the stone. Freedom in the air. Remember? She tempted it, picking at its memories of dancing free. Yes. Freedom. She nearly gave in herself. How wonderful would it be to no longer fear, to soar into infinity on the air, to be free of mortal pains. The tip of the stone burst into smoke, sending an explosion of bubbles up around the dinghy. Kaza was shocked back into the real world, and a peace deep within her trembled, terrified. She'd almost gone that time. Smoke bubbles rattled the dinghy, which nearly upended. She should have warned them. Sailors muttered, but in the next dinghy over, the captain praised her. She removed two more spear tips beneath the waves before finally reaching the wall. Here, the spearhead-like formations had been grown so close together, there was barely a hand-span gap between them. It took three tries to get the dinghy close enough. As soon as they got into position, some turning of the waves would pull them away again. Finally, the sailors managed to keep the dinghy steady. Kaza reached out with the soulcaster. Two of the three gems were almost out of stormlight and glowed only faintly.
She should have enough. She pressed her hand against the spike, then convinced it to become smoke. It was easy this time. She felt the explosion of wind from the transformation, her soul crying in delight at the smoke, thick and sweet. She breathed it in through the hole in her cheek while sailors coughed. She looked up at the smoke, drifting away. How wonderful it would be to join it. No. The island proper loomed beyond that hole. Dark, like its stones had been stained by smoke themselves, it had tall rock formations along its center. They looked almost like the walls of a city. The captain's dinghy pulled up to hers, and the captain transferred to her boat. His began to row backward.
What? She asked. Why is your boat heading back?
They claim to not be feeling well, the captain said. Was he abnormally pale?
Cowards. They won't have any of the prize, then.
Gemstones lay around just for the plucking here, Draws added. Generations of great shells have died here, leaving their hearts. We're going to be rich, rich men.
As long as the secret was here.
She settled into her place at the prow of the boat as the sailors guided the three dinghies through the gap. The Aemeans had known about soul casters. This was where you'd come to get the devices. In the old days, you'd come to the ancient island of Akina. If there was a secret of how to avoid death by the device she loved, she would find it here. Her stomach began acting up again as they rowed. Kaza endured it, though she felt as if she were slipping into the other world. That wasn't an ocean beneath her, but deep, black glass, and two suns in the sky, one that drew her soul toward it, her shadow to stretch out in the wrong direction. Splash! She started. One of the sailors had slipped from his boat into the water. She gaped as another slumped to the side, oar falling from his fingers. Captain. She turned to find him with drooping eyes. He went limp, then fell backward, unconscious, knocking his head against the back seat of the boat. The rest of the sailors weren't doing any better. The other two dinghies had begun to drift aimlessly. Not a single sailor seemed to be conscious.
My destiny, Kaza thought. My choice.
Not a thing to be carted from place to place and ordered to soul cast. Not a tool. A person. She shoved aside an unconscious sailor and took the oars herself. It was difficult work. She was unaccustomed to physical labor, and her fingers had trouble gripping. They'd started to dissolve further. Perhaps a year or two for her survival was optimistic. Still, she rowed. She fought the waters until she at long last got close enough to hop out into the water and feel rock beneath her feet. Her robes billowing up around her, she finally thought to check if Vazirmeb was alive. None of the sailors in her dinghy were breathing, so she let the boat slip backward on the waves. Alone, Kaza fought through the surf, and finally, on hands and knees, crawled up onto the stones of the island. There she collapsed, drowsy. Why was she so sleepy? She awoke to a small kremlin scuttling across the rocks near her. It had a strange shape, with large wings and a head that made it look like an axe hound. Its carapace shimmered with dozens of colors. Kaza could remember a time when she'd collected kremlins, pinning them to boards and proclaiming she'd become a natural historian. What had happened to that girl?
She was transformed by necessity.
Given the soul caster, which was always to be kept in the royal family, given a charge and a death sentence. She stirred, and the kremlin scrambled away. She coughed, then began to crawl toward those rock formations.
That city, dark city of stone?
She could barely think, though she did notice a gemstone as she passed it. A large, uncut gem heart among the bleached white carapace leftovers of a dead great shell. Vazirmeb had been right. She collapsed again near the perimeter of the rock formations, They looked like large, ornate buildings, crusted with creme.
"Ah," a voice said from behind her. "I should have guessed the drug would not affect you as quickly. You are barely human anymore."
Kaza rolled over and found someone approaching on quiet, bare feet. The cook?
Yes, that was her, with the tattooed face. "You," Kaza croaked. "You poisoned us." "After many warnings not to come to this place," the cook said. "It is rare I must guard it so aggressively. Men must not again discover this place." "The gemstones?" Kaza asked, growing more drowsy.
"Or is it something else? Something more?"
"I cannot speak," the cook said, "even to sate a dying demand. There are those who could pull secrets from your soul, and the cost would be the ends of worlds. Sleep now, soul caster. This is the most merciful end I could give."
The cook began to hum. Pieces of her broke off. She crumbled to a pile of chittering little kremlings that moved out of her clothing, leaving it in a heap.
"Hallucination?" Kaza wondered as she drifted. She was dying. Well, that was nothing new.
The kremlings began to pick at her hand, taking off her soul caster. No, she had one last thing to do. With a defiant shout, she pressed her hand to the rocky ground beneath her and demanded it change. When it became smoke, she went with it. Her choice. Her destiny.
Interlude 5. Taravangian. Taravangian paced in his rooms in Urethiru as two servants from the diagram arranged his table, and Fidgety Dukar, head of the king's testers, who each wore a ridiculous storm warden robe with glyphs all along the seams, set out the tests, though they needn't have bothered. Today, Taravangian was a storming genius. The way he thought, breathed, even moved, implicitly conveyed that today was a day of intelligence. Perhaps not as brilliant as that single transcendent one when he'd created the diagram, but he finally felt like himself after so many days trapped in the mausoleum of his own flesh, his mind like a master painter allowed only to whitewash walls. Once the table was finished, Taravangian pushed a nameless servant aside and sat down, grabbing a pen and launching into the problems, starting at the second page as the first was too simple, and flicking ink at Dukar when the idiot started to complain.
"Next page," he snapped. "Quickly, quickly! Let's not waste this, Dukar."
"You still must..."
"Yes, yes. Prove myself not an idiot. The one day I'm not drooling and lying in my own waste, you tax my time with this idiocy."
"You set it up."
"Yes, the irony is that you let the prohibitions instituted by my idiot self-control, my true self, when it finally has opportunity to emerge. You weren't an idiot when you..."
"Here,"
Taravangian said, proffering the sheet of math problems to him.
"Done."
"All but the last on this sheet," Dukar said, taking it in cautious fingers.
"Do you want to try that one, or—"
"No need. I know I can't solve it. Too bad. Make quick with the requisite formalities. I have work to do."
Advertagia had entered with Malata, the dustbringer. They were growing in companionship as Advertagia attempted to secure an emotional bond with this lesser diagram member, who had suddenly been thrust into its upper echelons, an event predicted by the diagram, which explained that the Dustbringers would be the Radiants most likely to accept their cause. And at that, Taravangian felt proud, for actually locating one of their number who could bond a sprend had not by any means been an assured accomplishment.
"He's smart,"
Dukar said to Maral. The bodyguard was the final adjudicator of Taravangian's daily capacity, an infuriating check necessary to prevent his stupid side from ruining anything, but a mere annoyance when Taravangian was like this: energized, awake, brilliant.
He's almost to the danger line,
Dukar said.
I can see that, Adrategia said. Vargo, are you? I feel perfect. Can't we be done with this? I can interact and make policy decisions and need no restrictions.
Dukar nodded, reluctantly, in agreement. Maral assented. Finally.
Get me a copy of the diagram,
Terabangian said, pushing past Adrategia.
And some music. Something relaxing, but not too slow. Clear the chambers of non-essential persons, empty the bedroom of furniture, and don't interrupt me!
It took them a frustratingly long time to accomplish, almost half an hour, which he spent on his balcony, contemplating the large space for a garden outside and wondering how big it was. He needed measurements.
Your room is prepared, Your Majesty, Maral said.
Thank you, Uscritic One, for your leave to go into my own bedroom. Have you been drinking salt?
What? Terabangian strode through the small room beside the balcony and into his bedroom, then breathed deeply, pleased to find it completely empty of furniture. Only four blank stone walls, no window, though it had a strange rectangular outcropping along the back wall, like a high step, which Mabin was dusting. Terabangian seized the maid by the arm and hauled her out to where Adrategia was bringing him a thick book bound in hogshide. A copy of the diagram.
Excellent. Measure the available gardening area of the stone field outside our balcony and report it to me.
He carried the diagram into the room and then shut himself into a blissful self-company in which he arranged a diamond in each corner, a light to accompany that of his own spark, which shone in truth where others could not venture. And as he finished, a small choir of children started to sing Borin hymns outside the room per his request. He breathed in, out, bathed in light and encouraged by song, his hands to the sides. Capable of anything, he was consumed by the satisfaction of his own working mind, unclogged and flowing freely for the first time in what seemed like ages. He opened the diagram. In it, Terabangian finally faced something greater than himself, a different version of himself. The diagram, which was the name for this book and for the organization that studied it, had not originally been written merely on paper, for on that day of majestic capacity, Terabangian had annexed every surface to hold his genius, from the cabinetry to the walls, and while so doing had invented new languages to better express ideas that had to be recorded, by necessity, in a medium less perfect than his thoughts. Even as the intellect he was today, the sight of that writing enforced humility. He leafed through pages packed with tiny scrawls, copied, spots, scratches, and all, from the original diagram room, created during what felt like a different lifetime, as alien to him now as was the drooling idiot he sometimes became. More alien. Everyone understood stupidity. He knelt on the stones, ignoring his aches of body, reverently leafing through the pages. Then he slipped out his belt knife and began to cut it up. The diagram had not been written on paper, and interacting with its transcription, bound into codex form, must necessarily have influenced their thinking. So to obtain true perspective, he now decided, he needed the flexibility of seeing the pieces, then arranging them in new ways, for his thoughts had not been locked down on that day, and he should not perceive them as such today. He was not as brilliant as he'd been on that day, but he didn't need to be. That day he'd been God. Today he could be God's prophet. He arranged the cutout pages and found numerous new connections simply by how the sheets were placed next to each other. Indeed, this page here actually connected to this page here. Yes. Terabangian cut them both down the middle, dividing sentences. When he put the halves of separate pages beside one another, they made a more complete whole. Ideas he'd missed before seemed to rise from the pages like spren.
Taravangian did not believe in any religion, for they were unwieldy things designed to fill gaps in human understanding with nonsensical explanations, allowing people to sleep well at night, granting them a false sense of comfort and control, and preventing them from stretching further for true understanding. Yet there was something strangely holy about the diagram. The power of raw intelligence, the only thing man should worship, and oh, how little most understood it. Oh, how little they deserved it, in handling purity while corrupting it with flawed understanding and silly superstitions. Was there a way he could prevent any but the most intelligent from learning to read? That would accomplish so much good. It seemed insane that nobody had implemented such a ban, for while Voronism forbade men to read, that merely prevented an arbitrary half of the population from handling information, when it was the stupid who should be barred. He paced in the room, then noted a scrap of paper under the door. It contained the answer to his question about the size of the farming platform. He looked over the calculations, listening with half an ear to voices outside, almost overwhelmed by the singing children.
"Us critic," Advertagia said, "seems to refer to Uscri, a figure from a tragic poem written 1700 years ago. She drowned herself after hearing her lover had died, though the truth was that he'd not died at all, and she misunderstood the report about him."
"All right," Moral said.
"She was used in following centuries as an example of acting without information, though the term eventually came to simply mean stupid. The salt seems to refer to the fact that she drowned herself in the sea."
"So it was an insult?" Moral asked.
"Using an obscure literary reference, yes." He could almost hear Adratagia's sigh. Best to interrupt her before she thought on this further. Taravangian flung open the door.
"Gum paste for sticking paper to this wall. Fetch it for me, Adratagia."
They'd put paper in a stack by the door without being asked, which surprised him, as they usually had to be ordered to do everything. He closed the door, then knelt and did some calculations relating to the size of the tower city. It proved a fine distraction, but he was soon drawn back to the true work, interrupted only by the arrival of his gum paste, which he used to begin sticking fragments of the diagram to his walls. This, he thought, arranging pages with numbers interspersing the text, pages they'd never been able to make sense of. It's a list of what? Not code, like the other numbers. Unless... could this be shorthand for words? Yes, yes, he'd been too impatient to write the actual words. He'd numbered them in his head, alphabetically, perhaps, so he could write quickly. Where was the key? This is reinforcement, he thought as he worked, of the Dalinar paradigm. His hands shook with excitement as he wrote out possible interpretations. Yes, kill Dalinar, or he will resist your attempts to take over Alethkar. Sir Taravangian had sent the assassin in white, which, incredibly, had failed. Fortunately, there were contingencies. Here, Taravangian thought, bringing up another scrap from the diagram and gluing it to the wall beside the others. The initial explanation of the Dalinar paradigm from the Catechism of the Headboard, backside third quadrant. It had been written in meter, as a poem, and presaged that Dalinar would attempt to unite the world. So if he looked to the second contingency... Taravangian wrote furiously, seeing words instead of numbers, and, full of energy, for a time he forgot his age, his aches, the way his fingers trembled. Sometimes, even when he wasn't so excited. The diagram hadn't seen the effect the second sun, Renarin, would have. He was a completely wild element. Taravangian finished his notations, proud, and wandered toward the door, which he opened without looking up.
"Get me a copy of the surgeon's words upon my birth," he said to those outside. "Oh, and kill those children!"
The music trailed off as the children heard what he'd said. Music Spren flitted away.
"You mean quiet them from singing,"
Morall said.
Whatever. I'm perturbed by the Voren hymns as a reminder of historic religious oppression of ideas and thought.
Taravangian returned to his work, but a short time later a knock came at the door. He flung it open.
I was not to be
interrupted, Andrategia said, proffering him a sheet of paper. The surgeon's words you requested. We keep them handy now, considering how often you ask for them.
Fine.
We need to talk, Vargo.
No, we...
She walked in anyway, then stopped, inspecting the cut-up pieces of the diagram. Her eyes widened as she turned about.
Are you... No, he said. I haven't become him again. But I am me, for the first time in weeks.
This isn't you. This is the monster you sometimes become.
I am not smart enough to be in the dangerous zone.
The zone where, annoyingly, they claimed he was too smart to be allowed to make decisions. As if intelligence were somehow a liability. She unfolded a piece of paper from the pocket of her skirt.
Yes, your daily test. You stopped on this page, claiming you couldn't answer the next question.
Damnation, she'd seen it.
If you'd answered, she said, it would have proved you were intelligent enough to be dangerous. Instead, you decided you couldn't manage, a loophole we should have considered. You knew that if you finished the question, we'd restrict your decision-making for the day. Do you know about stormlight growth?
He said, brushing past her and taking one of the pages he'd written earlier.
Vargo, calculating the total surface area for farming at Urethiru, he said, and comparing it to the projected number of rooms that could be occupied, I have determined that even if food grew here naturally, as it would at the temperatures of your average fecund plain, it could not provide enough to sustain the entire tower.
Trade, she said.
I have trouble believing the Knights Radiant, always threatened with war, would build a fortress like this to be anything but self-sufficient. Have you read Golombi?
Of course I have, and you know it, she said. You think they enhance the growth by use of stormlight-infused gemstones providing light to darkened places?
Nothing else makes sense, does it?
The tests are inconclusive, she said. Yes, sphere light inspires growth in a dark room when candlelight cannot, but Golombi says that the results may have been compromised and the efficiency is...
Oh, bah! That's a distraction, Vargo.
We were discussing what you've done to circumvent the rules you yourself set out.
When I was stupid.
When you were normal.
Normal is stupid, Adro.
He took her by the shoulders and firmly pushed her from the room.
I won't make policy decisions, and I'll avoid ordering the murder of any further groups of melodic children. Fine? All right? Now leave me alone. You're stinking up the place with an air of contented idiocy.
He shut the door and, deep down, felt a glimmer of shame. Had he called Advertagia, of all people, an idiot? Well, nothing to do about it now. She would understand. He set to work again, cutting out more of the diagram, arranging it, searching for any mentions of the Blackthorn, as there was too much in the book to study today, and he had to be focused on their current problem. Dalinar lived. He was building a coalition. So what did Taravangian do now? Another assassin? What is the secret? He thought, holding up sheets from the diagram, finding one where he could see the words on the other side through the paper. Could that have been intentional?
What should I do? Please, show me the way.
He scribbled words on a page. Light, intelligence, meaning. He hung them on the wall to inspire him, but he couldn't help reading the surgeon's words, the words of a master healer who had delivered Taravangian through a cut in his mother's belly. He had the cord wrapped around his neck, the surgeon had said. The queen will know the best course, but I regret to inform her that while he lives, your son may have diminished capacity, Perhaps this is one to keep on outer estates in favor of other heirs. The diminished capacity hadn't appeared, but the reputation had chased Teravangian from childhood, so pervasive in people's minds that not a one had seen through his recent act of stupidity, which they'd attributed to a stroke or to simple senility. Or maybe, some said, that was the way he'd always been. He'd overcome that reputation in magnificent ways. Now he'd save the world. Well, the part of the world that mattered. He worked for hours, pinning up more portions of the diagram, then scribbling on them as connections came to him, using beauty and light to chase away the shadows of dullness and ignorance, giving him answers. They were here. He merely needed to interpret them. His maid finally interrupted him. The annoying woman was always bustling around, trying to make him do this or that, as if he didn't have more important concerns than soaking his feet.
"Idiot woman!"
he shouted. She didn't flinch, but walked forward and put a tray of food down beside him.
"Can't you see that my work here is important?"
he demanded.
"I haven't time for food!"
She set out drink for him, then, infuriatingly, patted him on the shoulder. As she left, he noticed Advertagia and Moral standing right outside.
"I don't suppose," he said to Moral, "you'd execute that maid if I demanded it?"
"We have decided," the bodyguard said, "that you are not allowed to make such decisions today."
"To damnation with you, then. I almost have the answers anyway. We must not assassinate Dalinar Kholin. The time has passed for that. Instead, we must support his coalition. Then we force him to step down so that I can take his place at the head of the monarchs."
Advertagia walked in and inspected his work.
"I doubt Dalinar will simply give leadership of the coalition to you."
Teravangian rapped on a set of pages stuck to the wall.
"Look here! It should be clear even to you. I foresaw this."
"You've made changes," Moral said, aghast, "to the diagram."
"Only little ones," Teravangian said. "Look, see the original writing here? I didn't change that, and it's clear. Our task now is to make Dalinar withdraw from leadership, take his place."
"We don't kill him?" Moral asked.
Teravangian eyed him, then turned and waved toward the other wall with even more papers stuck to it.
"Killing him now would only raise suspicion."
"Yes," Advertagia said. "I see this interpretation of the headboard. We must push the Blackthorn so hard that he collapses. But we'll need secrets to use against him."
"Easy,"
Teravangian said, pushing her toward another set of notations on the wall.
"We send that Dustbringer's spren to spy. Dalinar Kholin reeks of secrets. We can break him, and I can take his place, as the Coalition will see me as non-threatening, whereupon we'll be in a position of power to negotiate with Odium, who will, by laws of Spren and Gods, be bound by the agreement made."
"Can't we beat Odium instead?" Moral asked.
"Muscle-bound idiot." Teravangian rolled his eyes, but Advertagia, more sentimental than he was, turned and explained.
"The diagram is clear, Moral," she said. "This is the purpose of its creation. We cannot beat the enemy, so instead we save whatever we can."
"The only way,"
Teravangian agreed. Dalinar would never accept this fact. Only one man would be strong enough to make that sacrifice. Teravangian felt a glimmer of something. Memory?
"Give me the capacity to save us."
"Take this,"
he said to Advertagia, pulling down a sheet he'd annotated.
"This will work."
She nodded, towing Moral from the room as Teravangian knelt before the broken, ripped, sliced-up remnants of the diagram.
"Light and truth. Save what he could. Abandon the rest."
Thankfully, he had been given that capacity.
Interlude 6. This one is mine. Venley was determined to live worthy of power. She presented herself with the others, a small group selected from the remaining listeners, and braced for the oncoming storm. She didn't know if Ulim, or his phantom masters, the ancient listener gods, could read her mind. But if they could, they'd find that she was loyal. This was war, and Venley among its vanguard. She had discovered the first Voidspren. She had discovered Stormform. She had redeemed her people. She was blessed. Today would prove it. 9 of them had been selected from among the 2,000 listener survivors, Venley included. Demid stood beside her with a wide grin on his face. He loved to learn new things, and the storm was another adventure. They'd been promised something great. See, Eshonai, Venley thought. See what we can do if you don't hold us back? All right, yes, that's it, Ulim said, rippling across the ground as vibrant red energy. Good, good, all in a line, keep facing west.
Should we seek for cover before the storm, Envoy?
Melu asked to the rhythm of agony.
Or carry shields?
Ulim took the form of a small person before them.
Don't be silly. This is our storm. You have nothing to fear.
And it will bring us power, Venley said.
Power beyond even that of Stormform? Great power, Ulim said. You've been chosen. You're special. But you must embrace this. Welcome it. You have to want it, or the powers will not be able to take a place in your gem hearts.
Venley had suffered so much, but this was her reward. She was done with a life spent wasting away under human oppression. She would never again be trapped, impotent. With this new power, she would always, always be able to fight back. The Everstorm appeared from the west, returning as it had before. A tiny village in the near distance fell into the storm's shadow, then was illuminated by the striking of bright red lightning. Venley stepped forward and hummed to Craving, holding her arms out to the sides. The storm wasn't like the high storms. No storm wall of blown debris and creme water. This was far more elegant. It was a billowing cloud of smoke and darkness, lightning breaking out on all sides, coloring it crimson. She tipped her head back to meet the boiling, churning clouds, and was consumed by the storm. Angry, violent darkness overshadowed her. Flecks of burning ash streamed past her on all sides, and she felt no rain this time, just the beat of thunder, the storm's pulse. Ash bit into her skin, and something crashed down beside her, rolling on the stones. A tree? Yes, a burning tree. Sand, shredded bark, and pebbles washed across her skin and carapace. She knelt down, eyes squeezed closed, arms protecting her face from the blown debris. Something larger glanced off her arm, cracking her carapace. She gasped and dropped to the stone ground, curling up. A pressure enveloped her, pushing at her mind, her soul.
Let me in.
With difficulty, she opened herself up to this force. This was just like adopting a new form, right? Pain seared her insides, as if someone had set fire to her veins. She screamed, and sand bit her tongue. Tiny coals ripped at her clothing, singeing her skin. And then a voice.
What is this?
It was a warm voice, an ancient paternal voice, kindly and enveloping. Please, Venley said, gasping in breaths of smoky air. Please.
Yes, the voice said. Choose another. This one is mine.
The force that had been pushing against her retreated, and the pain stopped. Something else, something smaller, less domineering, took its place. She accepted this spren gladly, then whimpered in relief, attuned to agony. An eternity seemed to pass as she lay huddled before the storm. Finally, the winds weakened, the lightning faded, the thunder moved into the distance. She blinked the grit from her eyes. Bits of cremstone and broken bark streamed from her as she moved. She coughed, then stood, looking at her ruined clothing and singed skin. She no longer bore storm form. She'd changed to... was this nimble form? Her clothing felt large on her, and her body no longer bore its impressive musculature. She attuned the rhythms and found they were still the new ones, the violent, angry rhythms that came with forms of power. This wasn't nimble form, but it also wasn't anything she recognized. She had breasts, though they were small, as with most forms outside of mate form, and long hair strands. She turned about to see if the others were the same. Demid stood nearby, and though his clothing was in tatters, his well-muscled body wasn't scored. He stood tall, far taller than her, with a broad chest and powerful stance. He seemed more like a statue than a listener. He flexed, eyes glowing red, and his body pulsed with a dark violet power, a glow that somehow evoked both light and darkness at once. It retreated, but Demid seemed pleased by his ability to invoke it. What form was that? So majestic, with ridges of carapace poking through his skin along the arms and at the corners of the face. Demid? She asked. He turned toward Melu, who strode up in a similar form and said something in a language Venli didn't recognize. The rhythms were there, though, and this was to derision. Demid? Venli asked again. How do you feel? What happened? He spoke again in that strange language, and his next words seemed to blur in her mind, somehow shifting until she understood them.
Odium rides the very winds, like the enemy once did. Incredible. Aharat, is that you?
Yes,
Melu said.
This feels good. Feel,
Demid said.
It feels.
He took a long, deep breath.
It feels.
Had they gone mad? Nearby, Maroon pulled himself past a large boulder which had not been there before. With horror, Venli realized that she could see a broken arm underneath it, blood leaking out. In direct defiance of Ulim's promise of safety, one of them had been crushed. Though Maroon had been blessed with a tall, imperious form like the others, he stumbled as he stepped away from the boulder. He grabbed the stone, then fell to his knees. His body coursing with that dark violet light, he groaned, muttering gibberish. Altoki approached from the other direction, standing low, teeth bared, her steps like those of a predator. When she drew closer, Venli could hear her whispering between bared teeth.
High sky, dead winds, blood rain.
Demid, Venli said to destruction. Something has gone wrong. Sit down. Wait. I will find the spren. Demid looked at her.
You knew this corpse?
This corpse? Demid, why... Oh, no! Oh, no! Oh, no! Ulim coursed across the ground to her.
You aren't... Oh, bad, bad.
Ulim, Venli demanded, attuning derision and gesturing at Demid. Something is wrong with my companions. What have you brought upon us?
Don't talk to them, Venli, Ulim said, forming into the shape of a little man. Don't point at them!
Nearby, Demid was pooling dark violet power in his hand somehow, studying her and Ulim.
It is you, he said to Ulim. The envoy. You have my respect for your work, spren.
Ulim bowed to Demid.
Please, Grand of the Fused, see passion and forgive this child.
You should explain to her, Demid said, so she does not aggravate me.
Venli frowned. What is...
Come with me, Ulim said,
rippling across the ground. Concerned, overwhelmed by her experience, Venli attuned agony and followed. Behind, Demid and the others were gathering. Ulim formed as a person again before her.
You're lucky. He could have destroyed you.
Demid would never do that.
Unfortunately for you, your once mate is gone. That's Hariel, and he has one of the worst tempers of all the Fused.
Hariel? What do you mean by...
She trailed off as the others spoke softly to Demid. They stood so tall, so haughty, and their mannerisms all wrong.
Each new form changed a listener down to their ways of thinking, even their temperament.
Despite that, you were always you. Even Stormform hadn't changed her into someone else. Perhaps she had become less empathetic, more aggressive, but she'd still been herself. This was different. Demid didn't stand like her once mate, or speak like him.
No, she whispered. You said we were opening ourselves up to a new spren, a new form.
I said, Ulim hissed, that you were opening yourselves up. I didn't say what would enter. Look, your gods need bodies. It's like this every return. You should be flattered.
Flattered? To be killed?
Yeah, for the good of the race, Ulim said. Those are the Fused, ancient souls reborn. What you have, apparently, is just another form of power. A bond with a lesser Voidspren, which puts you above common listeners, who have normal forms, but a step below the Fused. A big step.
She nodded, then started to walk back toward the group.
Wait, Ulim said, rippling across the ground before her. What are you doing? What is wrong with you?
I'm going to send that soul out, she said.
Bring Demid back. He needs to know the consequences before he can choose such a drastic... Back? Ulim said. Back? He's dead, as you should be. This is bad. What did you do? Resist like that sister of yours?
Out of my way.
He'll kill you. I warned of his temper.
Envoy,
Demid said to Destruction, turning toward them.
It wasn't his voice.
She attuned agony.
It wasn't his voice.
Let her pass, the thing with Demid's body said. I will speak with her.
Ulim sighed.
Father.
You speak like a human, Spren, Demid said. Your service here was grand. But you use their ways, their language. I find that displeasing.
Ulim rippled away across the stones. Venli stepped up to the group of Fused. Two still had trouble moving. They lurched, stumbled, fell to their knees. A different two wore smiles, twisted and wrong. The listener gods were not completely sane.
I regret the death of your friend, good servant, Demid said with a deep voice, fully in sync with the rhythm of command. Though you are the children of traitors, your war here is to be commended. You faced our hereditary enemies and gave no quarter, even when doomed.
Please, Venli said. He was precious to me. Can you return him?
He has passed into the blindness beyond, Demid said. Unlike the witless Voidspren you bonded, which resides in your gem heart, my soul cannot share its dwelling. Nothing, not regrowth or act of odium, can restore him now.
He reached out and took Venli by the chin, lifting her face, inspecting it.
You were to bear a soul I have fought beside for thousands of years. She was turned away. And you were reserved.
Odium has a purpose for you. Revel in that, and mourn not your friend's passing. Odium will bring vengeance at long last to those we fight."
He let go of her, and she had to struggle to keep herself from collapsing. No, no, she would not show weakness.
"But, damn it,"
she put him out of her mind, like Eshonai before him. This was the path she had placed herself on from the moment she'd first listened to Ulim years ago, deciding that she would risk the return of her people's gods. Demed had fallen, but she had been preserved, and Odium himself, god of gods, had a purpose for her. She sat down on the ground to wait as the fused conversed in their strange language. As she waited, she noted something hovering near the ground a short distance away. A little spren that looked like a ball of light. Yes, she'd seen one of those